This week on RSVMB Update, we return with another lore review, this time covering the Stormguard Citadel and everything Aviancy. Plus, we have updates on the World Cup of Quests and the Audio Team Showcase. And finally, a certain podcast turns 15. We'll detail all the festivities. This is RSVMB Update, episode 781, recorded Thursday, June 11th, 2020, The Quest That Shall Not Be Named. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of RSVMB Update. This week is, of course, a week that everybody's been waiting for. It is the time in which we get to cover the lore of the Stormguard Citadel. And, you know, I really liked our Infernal Source one, and we got great reviews from the people who listened to that one. So we're going to do it again with Stormguard. I'm going to streamline it a bit from what we did last time, but we took everybody's commentary in on it and did that. And I think we got a much more streamlined version of it, and we're still going to deliver all the lore through it. And of course, joining us to aid in this is Diana. Welcome back.
Hello.
Sirion's also here to ask the hard questions, as he is each and every week.
Hello.
And myself and Tanis will guide this discussion, furthering our knowledge and expertise of lore about Big Bird, as some people call him in RuneScape.
Thunder Chicken.
So we're gonna dive into the lore after the patch notes and whatnot. But first, I just have to I just want to dance around a bit here, because this week's episode is a very special episode, and you know, we made a decision to do the lore episode this week when I could have done something else that, you know, would have been a lot more nostalgic, and I'm gonna try and do that next week for you guys. But this week marks the 15th anniversary of the first episode of RSVMB Update.
Oh, congratulations.
And I always have to go back to this first episode, because it was me and a guy that we met runecrafting. His name was Pika69. And we both had this idea, yeah, let's start up this podcast. It'd be, you know, the first RuneScape radio show. And it was. And you know, this was very early back on in the day, of course. This is back when you had to use Skype to talk to people, back when, you know, there really was no rhyme or reason of how to get good audio out of a computer and how to do that over the internet. Of course, we've come so far in the technology that we have on that. All the episodes are up on the website. So if you want to go listen to how painful that was back in the day, you can go and do that. But I did listen to some of that in preparation for something else that we're working on, which I'll talk about in the Patreon section. But we have come so far since then. And, you know, I always have to point out that our first update that we ever discussed on this show was the seeds and farming equipment that they added a month before the launch of farming.
Of course.
Yeah, and, you know, there are these moments where you remember exactly what you were doing for a specific episode of the podcast, and that's one of them. And, of course, all the skill launches are other ones. And, you know, I have many stories that we're going to go into, and we'll do that next week, have a proper anniversary episode for that. But I wanted to do Stormguard this week, because it's been a while since we've done Infernal Source, so I decided that, you know, 15th anniversary, it's not the 20th anniversary, so let's just plow on and do Stormguard this week. So, you know, we're perhaps getting sentimental a bit in my old age here of doing this show, and I've got Tanis. I forget how long you've been around here for. Do you know?
I think 2013 I started Informer. And I've been with you for a while now. It's like a marriage. Sometimes it seems forever. And then sometimes it seems like it's only been a little bit. Yeah, it's weird. But I don't know. It's like 3 years, I think.
Yeah, I think you started in 2017 officially, because 2016 was the weird year where we split that apart into four. And little did you guys know that splitting 2016 into four was an audition to determine who would host 2017.
Hey.
Yeah. But, I mean, everybody
– I didn't make a cut. Thanks.
You didn't let me finish my sentence. Everybody did very well.
Okay.
All right.
Well, and I mean, Sirion's all – I mean, anytime we need him, here he is. So.
Yeah. And you guys did a wonderful – you guys did a wonderful job hosting last year when I was gone.
That was fun.
Oh, that was so much fun.
But I won't be going away again anytime soon because you know why.
Because you don't have any friends.
So, all right.
What?
Let us begin then. Patch notes. So we're gonna start off with the rather inconsequential ones that didn't ruffle any feathers. Then we're gonna end with the big kahuna. So in archaeology this week, the Blood Reaver Familiar will now apply its passive ability to life point, boosting effects such as Ceridoman Bruise and Rocktail. Have you guys ever looked into using one of these Blood Reavers, or does everybody just water fiend or bust?
Water fiend.
Because that's just,
I don't know.
What?
Yeah, I don't
What is the Blood Reaver familiar?
The Blood Reaver is the one that deals 25% of your healing to the target. And yes, it's an ancient binding contract.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. I imagine that might be used for mid-level Slayer, because that kind of makes sense on that front. Other changes this week, players need to no longer have completed the Throne of Miscellanea to travel to the Spirit Tree on the island, which is interesting because I thought you needed – that was the whole point of doing the quest, was to unlock the island, because you could only get there through the quest. But I guess completed implies that you could start the quest and just gain access to it and use the Spirit Tree.
There. Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Because I think there's combat involved, so that probably bodes well for skill peers if they can unlock that quest without that. But I don't know what that requirement is off the bat. Invention farming and runecrafting teleports will now appear as options on the skills necklace.
I thought that was a great update. I think the skills and necklace and a combat bracelet, they just have a little bit of love, you know. Before we had the Max Guild and War's Retreat, that was the way of getting around. That was like the Dragonstone jewelry, you know. It used to be the way of getting around the world, I think.
Yeah,
and it's a bit of a shame it has been devalued. So, well,
I mean, it's still very useful for clue hunters, you know.
I have a bunch of them in my bank as well, but. I think this is great.
Yeah. Just a reminder for everybody else where else it goes. In addition to the Invention Guild, the Farming Guild, and the Runecrafting Guild, it also goes to the Fishing Guild, the Mining Guild, the Crafting Guild, and the Cooking Guild, amongst other places. The Fair Venturer outfit no longer leaves a hole in the player's back while smithing.
Oh.
Yeah. I guess you could say that your player has become very holy prior to this update if you wore this outfit.
There you go.
5 minute mute.
Thank you. Fixed an issue where rejoining the instance after logging out of the world would reset the spawn speed setting on boss instances. Doesn't really affect me, but good to know that's been fixed. And, you know, I think we might have noticed that back in the day when we were doing Vindicta, that it kind of slowed down after logging out. Darkmire's Anvil is now marked with the appropriate icon on the map. Speaking of this, does anybody want to do an old school episode of Update where we talk about the Darkmire quest that they got and compare it to RS3?
Oh, it's made me want to play old school, seeing all the hype about it. It looks really good.
That and Song of the Elves, right?
Yeah, it looks really good.
If they didn't require super high requirements, I would totally be playing that right now.
But. Or if they didn't have potato graphics and a UI that's not flexible.
I'm not even sure if those bother me the most of all things, to be honest.
All right. Awkward topic aside, you can tell that's... We had the old school discussion last time we had this crew on, didn't we?
Yeah.
That was probably subliminally why I brought this up. Cows and sheep will no longer become horribly deformed in the add and remove animal interface.
Oh, yay, they stopped being cursed.
Fixed an issue that was preventing evil trees from being interacted with. And this was the one that many people had wanted to be fixed. And who was the J-Mod that brought this forward, that the fix had been checked in and then we got it this week? Mod... We mentioned his name in pre-show, guys. I forget his name now. I'm sorry.
I think Mod Orion was mentioned.
It was Orion.
There we go. Orion. And, you know, do you guys still do evil trees, or is that more of a mid-level endeavor, I would think?
No, I don't. What is there to gain from it? For
Woodcutting XP.
Why would I want woodcutting XP?
If you're going for 120 like I am.
Why would I want to go for 120?
All right, fair enough.
Completionist.
Yeah, that's your own choice. Resolved an issue that would cause the incorrect poison color to be applied to a player during the Viraklith boss fight. NPCs in the Heart of Gilanor will no longer be able to attack through the entrances in the boss waiting areas. That's interesting.
Don't stand too close.
Yeah. Fixed an issue that caused female characters' torsos to detach from their legs while wearing the raider chain body or the slave shirt.
Huh.
Interesting. Also fixed a problem that caused Infinity Ethereal legs to stretch while worn with a small delivery parcel. Fixed an issue where the leaf trap in the northernmost hunter training area in Tyrannan could sometimes jump you back west when jumping eastwards across it. Wow.
That's nice.
And fixed an issue where skill cape hoods wouldn't display their retro counterpart even when toggled to do so. All right. And then we get to the big kahuna at the end of the day here. A bug that allowed players to bypass the 50% chance of destroying memories while converting memories using the Divine-O-Matic has been resolved.
So, Shane, I assume you copied this. Did you copy this from the patch notes?
Yes, I did.
Directly?
Yes, I did.
Did you copy this from the patch notes directly within the few hours after releasing after the patch notes were released?
This was copied today.
Yeah, because it said something much, much different.
All right.
Which caused a bit of an uproar.
What do you know offhand what it said? I mean, I think we have that somewhere, but...
I don't know from the top of my head.
And
it said something about, you know, when you used... when you use the relic, the archaeology relic, I don't know the name of it, that allows you to convert all memories in one go. Together with the Divine Hoover, Divine-O-Matic, I will call it the Divine Hoover.
Divine Hoover.
Because that is the only right name for it.
The Divine Conversion Relic is what we're talking about here.
Yeah, exactly. So if you use those together, it will now destroy 50% of the memories. That's what it said.
Right.
Which, you know, is what it's supposed to do. It's what is expected. However, it's not what it was doing. Instead, it was bypassing that check, which meant that with combining those two things, you get double the divine charges filled.
Uh-huh.
Which, of course, is a massive deal. So that needed to be fixed. All good and well, right? But the way it was phrased didn't clarify it was a bug. So a lot of people interpreted this as a nerf. I think it might even have said nerf in the actual text, but don't quote me on this. So a lot of people were blowing up about how this is a nerf, how this was... I mean, there were people being so pedantic saying, but it was mentioned as an archaeology improvement, so it must have been an intentional change to the game instead of a bug fix. And discussions like that. So a lot of people got hurt over this because, you know, it's a big deal. If you use this to get rich, then you can't anymore.
Right. And
a lot of people were panic buying Divine Charges.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah.
So I just want to read the description of what Divine Conversion does. When activated, players will convert their entire inventory of divination memories when using a divination rift. And the question is, to anybody who has a Divine Hoover, Divine-O-Matic, in what world do you have divination memories in your inventory if you're using one of these?
The Divine-O-Matic has two modes, right? And all, like 90% of the people use the fully out AFK mode, which, I mean, it's great, right? It's just awesome.
Yeah. Yeah,
no. You can also have it on not consumption mode, in case you do get the memories, and you can hand them in at the rift still.
Okay.
And the energy no you get from that.
I forgot about that second mode.
But yeah. Because no one would ever use it.
No, exactly. But this combination allowed you to bypass it, so it became really, really powerful. And now people are like, oh, why would you ever use the relic and the Hoover at the same time? And like, no, you wouldn't. They're sort of separate things.
It wasn't designed to be used in concert with the relic.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can't.
I remember talking on the show, Shane, when we talked about that relic. We're like, why would I don't really, you know, fine, but not much of a case for it if you got the Hoover.
Well, and what we found, and what we found after the fact is that energy was actually selling for more than charges,
right?
Because people were buying the energy to make porters.
Yeah.
And you know, this 50% to destroy. I still think that the Divine Conversion relic is going to be a better option than the Divine Hoover if you're going just for energy.
Yeah, I agree. It's just that the Divine Hoover is basically for the AFK, right? It's so easy.
Yeah.
So people will still use that as well. And this is awesome. This is one of these places where there's two ways of doing it, and they have different pros and cons. And I think neither of us thinks that one of these ways is not viable at all. Like, both of them are super
absolutely.
Viable.
All three of them are super viable.
So it's amazing. Like, this is exactly the balance that we need in scaling in general. So, you know, all you people who complain about your favorite method being quote-unquote nerfed, suck it, because this is how it's supposed to be.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're going for pure energy, use the relic. If you're going for energy but AFK, use the Divine-O-Matic on its energy gathering mode. Or if you're just going for divine charges, use the Divine-O-Matic the way 90% of people do.
Yeah. I mean, using the Divine-O-Matic where you still get the memories. You can use that to fill divine charges while also getting the XP thing for the memory. So
right.
You know, it's a sort of a middle way between the two options. I think it's great. I think it's one of the better thought out pieces of the game. So
right, because you know, and people are going to say, why is this a bad thing? But prior to this, if you were doing divination, you would want to have this relic on all the time, and you would bypass this, and there would be one surefire way to go. If you wanted pure energy, and that would be to use the relic in concert with the Divine-O-Matic and not have this 50% category. Whereas now there's even more choice to be made, and as we've talked many times before, where you're making choices and you're forced to sacrifice things, that often signals good game design and just creates more different ways that players can play the content.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and look, I saw this discussion happening, you know, with us, and I thought, oh, shit. Here we go, man. And so I start checking the sources, you know, the places where I'm looking for it to be, and it was only in one area, And I thought maybe a hand, from what I gathered, it looked like a handful of posts. I didn't go back and forth with a lot of the comments. I don't know. I was just looking at the post. Now, you know, my credit on being anti-nerf is good. Like, I got the street credit on that. And I'm saying, don't cry wolf on this, people. One, I don't think a lot of people were. I think it's the typical handful, loudmouth kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if you whine and cry every time when it's such an obvious bug fix, you're hurting the cause, man. You're making my job harder every time I have to argue for a nerf that I don't think was right. This is a bug fix. You know how I know that? Because pre-archaeology, it didn't change. So I don't understand how anyone could be like, oh, it's supposed to be that way. Well, no one, because it didn't work that way before.
But Canis, it's supposed to be that way because the players know but best and they say so.
Yeah, but that, but you know me, Shane. Like,
I know.
You can't cry wolf on this shit because no one's going to listen to you when it counts.
Yeah, and it's a question of when you want to pull out the scissors and not, right? Or if you're going to pull out a chainsaw.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say, like, the communication on this, you know, it just wasn't great. Like, if this thing that you just named out, let me repeat it. A bug allowing players to bypass the 50% chance of destroying memories while converting memories using the Devanimatic has been resolved. If that had been in the patch notes, I think not a soul would have complained besides the people who would complain about everything.
But
anyway,
there was even
right?
this explainer down below that said what it did prior to when they changed it.
Oh, Shane, yeah, but once you read half of a sentence and you don't like it, that's... Mm-mm.
Oh, I know.
You didn't even finish it, let alone read the disclaimer.
No, but it didn't say it was fixing a bug. It literally says, yeah. If you use these two in combination, we now destroy 50% of your memories. If you read it, like, without going into understanding it, if you've read it, like you skimmed it, that's what it said. If you use these two things, we just started destroying 50% of your memories.
Yeah. I just want to read
bad communication.
I just want to read the explainer before we move on because it's been a while and maybe bring Diana in on this after I read this. The Devanimatic has a 50% chance of destroying memories, rendering them useless. This has always been the case and was done to ensure the rate of divine charges coming into the game from the item was balanced. The new archaeology relic allowed you to bypass this mechanic, meaning the Devanimatic was producing far too many charges. Now converting memories at a rift with the Devanimatic equipped will respect the 50% destroy mechanic of the item. Having the Devanimatic configured to destroy both memories and energy will remain unaffected.
Where was this?
That was right below the patch note.
So I'm even more dumb. I mean, I guess people just didn't read it, dude. I don't know. I don't know what else to say. Like,
I was at some point laughing my butt off. People were like, "But it's under archaeology improvements."
It's not even under archaeology improvements. It's under other fixes.
I think in like the news post, it was under like archaeology improvements. I don't know. People were.
People
I don't
love
know.
To be pedantic.
And if that is the level of, but I think part of this is, you know, people just want to find something to whine about because people are upset that they aren't getting actual content. So they need something to whine about to express that.
Yes, I saw a lot more of that than the other. But I also want to say, too, like, our places to gauge what the quote-unquote community is are kind of – I mean, there's only so many places you can go, right? And so the one place we always end up looking, I'm really beginning to feel it's just not representative of the community at large anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I really feel like it's going another direction.
The wording on the news post was that the Divine-O-Matic vacuum was overperforming when siphoning energy and has therefore been adjusted. From now on, it has a 50% chance to destroy memories both when siphoning just energy and also when siphoning both energy and memories together. Ooh, there's your nerf.
Yeah, that's confusing. Exactly. I mean, that's a little confusing.
Exactly. That's like, I was like, oh, that's a bug fix, right? Because, you know, I know how these things happen, and I think some people got that, but I think a lot of people didn't get that was a bug fix. And they could have just changed the text, take out all the ambiguity, and it would have been smooth sailing through the week.
Well, just call it a bug fix instead of trying to get cutesy. Like, cutesy doesn't add content to the patch note, okay? Doesn't really add much to it. Just makes it harder to communicate.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, I know no one here got their knickers in a knot over it. So if you have, hopefully this has been a good explainer for you. But of course, now comes the part of the podcast everybody has been waiting for weeks probably. The Stormguard Citadel. And it's lore.
You're really hyping up, Shane. I hope I can live up to this.
Well, I mean, I find it, you know, one of the most graphically appealing ones out there. So let's dive and see what we got with this then.
So, Stormguard. What did you guys think of this site? I think before we dive in, your general impressions. Did you like it? Did you not like it? What did you make of it?
I think Stormguard was one of those places that I was looking forward to going to most. Yeah. It was one of those places where it's like, you know, that sounds... I've always been a fan of the citadels, the clan citadels. They're not as graphically impressive anymore as they were when they were first released. But the fact that the disco floor is visible to floors and all that stuff is probably not helping that. But, you know, like citadels and all that stuff has, I found it super interesting. So yeah, I was really excited to go to it. I think graphically it looks super impressive. I think it is atmospheric and it really feels, it almost feels like a place that has its own history.
Yeah.
It's such a pain to navigate.
There you go. And that's the next thing I was going to say. Like the flying is wonderful the way it was done. Like whoever would have thought your RuneScape character would have been able to fly? Now you can with Stormguard. And I'll agree with you on the navigating. It gets a little bit easier after you charge the portals, but still a pain, especially for the level 95 divination spot, which you have to stay to until 97. So I am, for those two levels after getting the collections done, I'm just farming Tetra Compass pieces because I don't want to use porters to, you know, farm that 95 divination spot. And the reason why, or I said divination, I meant archaeology. The reason why it's so painful is that you have to fly to one of the carts to deposit if you're not using porters, which is kind of a inconvenience. But, you know, that's really my only complaint about the dig site. But aside from that, I'd say graphically, it's, I think Everlight's still my favorite graphically, and this is probably a second or a third.
This was the one I was looking most forward to getting to, and somehow the one that I've spent the least time at. I think because once I got there, it was hard to navigate, and so I didn't spend a lot of time there. Like, I don't really even have my whole suit yet to go around, because the first few islands, I'm like, ugh. It's kind of a pain. And then I was able to jump past it, so I just went ahead and kept going, you know.
All right. What do you think, Diana?
That's fair.
Since you asked the question.
It.
Okay.
I really, really love this one. I was looking forward to it because, well, we saw the previews of it and I thought it looked really, really stunning, really pretty. And also, we know nothing about Armadil. We know jack shite about Armadil, so here's our first time to find out more about Aviancy culture on Gilenor. What were they like?
That's because we didn't get that quest that we have been promised.
The quest
for.
That we are not going to be, we're not going to name, because every time someone says the name of it, it gets delayed by 3 years.
Yeah, so, exactly.
We're not going to name the quest.
Elemental Workshop 5?
No, we're not doing this.
No, we're not doing it.
So yeah, fantastic opportunity to finally get to learn a bit more about Armadyl. And yeah, I think I've made up another notes page about it.
And we'll have it linked in the show notes at the end of the day. update.rsbnb.com. So let's begin. You know, it's Temple of Ikov. Who would have thought that would have been the place, right?
Yeah, I remember in our little pre-skill launch lore summary thing back in March now, quite a long time ago now, I thought maybe there'd be a link to Temple of Ikov, the quest from 2002. But I thought, yeah, no, that's not actually going to happen. Turns out it's actually quite an important part of the story. So I had to go all the way back and recap what happened in Temple of Ikov, because it's been a very, very long time since I did that quest. I couldn't actually remember doing it, so I had to go all the way back onto the wiki and look up the transcript for it.
Long time ago.
Is this the Underground Pass quest? No.
This is the quest where you first meet Lucien. The very, very first one, he's kind of disguised as a human. And what you have to do is go to the Temple of Ikov. There's a trapdoor at the memorial where you can go up to the citadel. There's also like a trapdoor going underground. And you go into there and you steal the Staff of Armadyl from the Guardians of Armadyl. And you either choose to not give it to Lucien or you give it to him.
Yeah.
And that's kind of...
That was one of our first Armadyl references, wasn't it?
One of the first Armadyl references, first reference to Lucien, first reference to the Guardians of Armadyl, the Staff of Armadyl. Yeah. Loads of stuff that ended up being really important in Wal'gathic Sleeps and Ritual of the Majorat, and all sorts of really big 5th Age quests kind of started here.
I just remembered that you had to be lighter than 0 kilos when weight was still a thing.
When weight mattered, yeah.
Yeah, no, but like back in the day, you know, you wanted those boots and you wanted the capes, the spotted spottier capes. And, you know, that was all a big deal when you did any running in the game. And, you know, that the boots of lightness.
It seems like it might have been a skill that was more important back. It's eluding me right now.
Agility. Anyways. Not going down that path, but anyways.
Soon.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
All right.
So yeah, this is where you start. You can talk to Geeka, I think it's how you say her name, who previously had an appearance in the Bird and Beast World event. She was known as the Golem Master, the Armadylian Golem Master. Right. So she's the site manager for this one. I haven't really come across her character before. I don't know anything about her other than that she's an Aviancy. That's it, as far as I know. So she's not like Mavario, and who's already had an important part.
Or Zanik at Warforged.
Or Zanik.
I think it's kind of telling that they had to resort to a world event NPC.
Well, how many other prominent Aviancy are there?
Yeah, no, exactly. But that's what, like, that's really telling that, you know, they had to grasp at such so far away to get a site manager that makes sense here. Well, for all the other sites, we have someone that's just, you know, we know them, it makes sense. And here it's like, oh, we need an Aviancy.
We never told the story before.
Well, most of them are dead, to be fair. So we do lose a couple more of them in there.
Okay.
So yeah, it's nice to have a bit of a talk to her and see what the site's about. We find out more about the Ikovians as well. Is that I don't actually know if that's how you meant to say it. Ikov?
I think Ikovians work. Or
yeah. So they were a settlement.
You just like that because it sounds like Iconian.
I never said that. Continue.
So yeah, this was a settlement of humans from the Third Age. And at some point during the Third Age, something happened to them. And Armadyl, the phrase she uses, intervenes on their behalf. Don't know what that means, but from then on, they follow Armadyl and they become the precursors to the Guardians of Armadyl. So that's the link between the Temple of Ikov and Armadyl. He helped them out at some point in the Third Age, and they became some of his human followers. So it's nice to get that. You get one lore book from digging up the sites, the little Ikovian memorial excavations here, called Atonement. And it was a bit of a surprise. I kind of half recognized the name of the author, fire warrior of Lazarkus. And turns out, going through the Temple of Ikov quest transcript, that's one of the bosses in the quest.
Huh. I was thinking you use like ice bolts or something.
The fire warrior,
like that.
Yeah? Right, yeah. This is the fire warrior. This is their lore description. Turns out they were a Terra Guardian of all places, going back to Terra Guard here, which is quite a reference. A human who was spying on them. And again, this bad thing happened, something mysterious and bad happened to the Ikovians. And I think Laker might have been involved. Not really sure. It's not said explicitly what happens. But they don't blame them for whatever happens. And in return, kind of in repayment, in atonement, name of the book, they decide to stand vigil over the temple and protect it and become the boss of the quest much later on.
So it sounds like we're still missing a big piece of the puzzle on this about what happened after this, unless we're going to move further into this. And I might be...
It's never actually answered. What actually happened to the Ikovians, I don't think is ever actually answered. I don't know whether that'll come up later on. Not in the dig site, but later on in the story, but it's never really explored further.
Well, there's another quest line we could follow, but maybe it just wasn't important.
I don't feel like it's hugely important. I mean, it is a blank space. Who knows what actually happened there?
Because going back, I think what Temple of Ikov is remembered for, of course, is Lucian and the Staff of Armadil. Mm-hmm. And then I think the next time we see Lucian after that is while Guthix sleeps, right?
Yeah, and by that point he's recruited Mavario.
Yes.
To be his goon.
All right. Back to Stormguard then. I realize, I feel like we're kind of just on the periphery here of all the big events that happened with while Guthix sleeps, but it could be Majorat themed, but we're definitely approaching this from an Aviancy Armadil standpoint because this is indeed Stormguard.
Yeah,
that was weird to me back in the day too. Anyways.
Mm.
I think it's kind of nice how they did it because, I mean, it comes back to a discussion we had when archaeology came out, how, you know, having everything sort of in the world and connected to existing lore and putting material caches in existing sites, it grounds the skill much more. And I think if they had gone with a pure Aviancy story here, it would not have had any ties with existing lore. Yeah. Because it is so unexplored. So, yeah, it's very unexplored territory. And this way, you know, there's this little string that connects this part of the lore to all the other stuff, which instantly makes it much more interesting and much more realistic. And I think that is actually really, really genius, how they sort of made the Temple of Ikov, this transition between Gilenor, like the lore of Gilenor and the lore of the Aviancy.
Yeah, you're right. It is kind of the mesh point between what we know so far and the unknown, and kind of that can be almost part of the metaphor of you're on the ground of Gilenor, finding out stuff you sort of already know, starting to creep into unknown stuff, and then you shoot up the Stormguard where it's all completely new.
But yeah, exactly.
Because you've had this grounding in existing lore, you care about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to know more.
Exactly.
All right, well, let's learn more.
Yeah, so it's kind of similar to the Infernal Force in that sense, kind of in terms of the story structure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then once you've dug up a Garet... Okay. Ikovian
Garej, I'd say. That's Garej. The way I'd say that.
It's a Mongolian word, and I know nothing about that language, so I can't pronounce it right. I'm very, very sorry if I do mess that up. But once you've dug up that kind of gives you a pass to head up through the portal to the Stormguard Citadel itself. And yeah, up you go. Again, I mentioned this with the Infernal Source, where for their big reveal, they use the camera angles to really emphasize the wow moment. And they do the same thing here. When you come up from the portal, your camera's facing down, as it usually is. So you come up and you pan around, and that's when you get this amazing skybox. These huge purple clouds swirling around, and the sunlight striking through it all.
And the trees blowing in the wind.
The wind is such a really nice touch. Go on.
So this is sort of like allows you to explore the thing by yourself, but by turning the camera, right? Even though you're sort of limited to the first island when you join. We'll get to that in a sec, I guess. But I think in a lot of different games, and even in some places in RuneScape, when you enter like a new area, you get this like swooping cutscene to like this new area and sort of like, you know, making it almost like a cinematic where the camera just swoops to the environment.
Yeah.
Which is definitely something we've seen done before in RuneScape.
That's usually done in levels where the camera really wants you to pay attention to certain things. So if, for example, you enter a new area or a new level, you might get a 30-second cutscene where the camera will show you the route. Like, it'll fly through the area showing you where the key points are, where are your points of focus. And that's not done here. So you discover it yourself.
Right.
It's a nice little touch, I find.
I sort of feel that because with a cinematic, you're much less limited in sort of the camera angles. Like, even as a player, you know, we're sort of locked in our camera angles. I feel we can never really enjoy the full grandeur of this massive place.
I mean, we have free cam. We have free cam.
Yeah, but like, I don't think a normal player would use that, right?
I use it all the time. Especially in these sites, you put on free cam and have a whiz around and just kind of really appreciate the scale of it.
I wonder if it might be a conscious choice. I almost feel this is a missed opportunity. You know, they have this beautiful environment. Why not swoop to it and make everybody sort of go to that experience? But
I guess the arguments
go both ways.
I quite like the whole give the player the discovery moment. Because then what I found, whenever you first teleport up to the Storm Guard, you actually get a little bit of dialogue from your player saying, wow, this place looks amazing, or something, or I wasn't expecting this, I think is the line.
Well, you are going to spend a good deal of time looking there because you can't really move off that first island until you get your boots.
Yeah. But you get a little hint that it looks amazing, so you look up and you look around, and then once you start seeing this unusual environment that's very, very different to what we've seen before,
you kind of
get drawn into the wow moment instead of being shown it. I really like that, but I can see what you're saying, like a cinematic kind of panning all the way through it and showing this off the scale of it would have been pretty cool as well.
I think that's something that the skill in general does really well, which is show, don't tell, right? Which is
show, don't tell in this, yeah.
It's a storytelling trope that, you know, like exposition is often done through like long conversations and all that stuff. But this skill and the lore inside it is really, they do a really good job of making you sort of experience the lore over time.
There's a lot of environmental storytelling.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of it, which is actually done quite cleverly as well. It feels really organic, and as part of a skill rather than as part of a quest, I think is one of the highlights of it for me. Particularly even in the artifacts you discover as you go along, you can pick up bits of story and bits of culture through the act of skilling and act of discovering these things, which is awesome, and we've not seen it in game before. One of my favorite things about it.
I agree. And, you know, it'd be nice if that would be something that we'd see more of, I think. And, you know, I think that's also why people latched on so much to archaeology when it first arrived.
I think in that, like before RuneFest even, I think they said at some point they wanted the game to be more narrative driven, right?
They wanted to bring narrative into more content that wasn't quests.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I think this is a great example of it, and I think Anachronia is a good example of it.
I'm looking forward to what they do with the Anachronia dig site on that front. I feel like that could be very, very
No, we're a long ways off of that.
We are, yes.
Yeah. All right. So where do we go next for lore? And I mean, this is, you can imagine, a bit of a walkthrough of Stormguard. We get to the main area, the central island.
What I'm
going to
do is kind of go island by island in order of level. So I'm going to start with the recreation island, which is the central one that you first land on. So you pick up your boots of flight from the Icovian memorials that are up here by the Stormguard portal. And you get drawn up towards a couple of larger pieces of rock, larger islands, kind of towards the northeast. Here you get the Keshet Gur, more really strong Mongolian influences there. You can uncover musical instruments. And this is another, I think I mentioned it in the Infernal Source, where you uncover artwork.
Yeah.
Here's the equivalent. You're uncovering instruments. It's completely unnecessary to the lore, unnecessary to the skill, but it adds so much. Like, it's
not
to the culture. It's Aviancy culture, which we've never seen. We know nothing about. But again, the environmental storytelling, you're bringing in these aspects that they are bird people. So of course song is going to be an important part of their culture when you think about it.
Which, you know... Which is a bit weird, because when you say that, you think that, oh, okay. Oh, yeah, what's the first thing you hear when the birds are around in the morning? Birdsong.
Yeah, it makes sense that music is going to be, even in a weapons facility like Stormguard's, that they're going to have music. I love that. I thought that was such a nice little touch. So unnecessary, but kind of a nice bit of flavor. You get that here. You also get one of the first research, kind of where you can examine a piece of scenery and send your research team after it. It's called Dearly Departed. Looking at the megaliths that are kind of scattered around all over the place, and when you examine them, they say they look like deer stones.
Interesting. I never noticed that.
Yeah, so if you examine the Aviancy Center Pass, subcultures call these deer stones, which are based on real-life kind of artifacts that you find in Central Asia. Historians aren't really sure what they are meant to be in real life, but in-game they've been characterized as memorial stones to dead Aviancy. Quite a sad little one. It says here that Aviancy typically fight alongside a partner, and if one of the coupling dies, the survivor typically joins the day guard or the night guard. That becomes their new family. So the day guard and the night guard, as we find out later on, are the soldiers that are stationed at Stormguard. So they're the defending force. So they're all made up of widowed Aviancy, which I thought was quite somber and quite sad.
Yeah,
But it's also kind of... I mean, yes, but on the other hand, like, it's kind of nice... that, you know, sort of find, I almost want to say like a second life, right? Like a sort of new way to sort of deal with that loss. Like it, I find it a very constructive way to deal with loss that they...
It's an interesting note of how they operate kind of on a social level. Mm-hmm. So they have this close fighting partner, and then when they lose that, they go and find a new family somewhere else, but they don't choose another partner. They just become part of the guard.
Yeah, there's a little sort of, yeah, it's very poetic in a way, it feels alien, in a way.
It's sufficiently non-human for it to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
but it's also very relatable and very understandable, and I think that sort of hits that right distance, that right. Yeah, so it feels really natural. While also being interesting and unique.
Yeah, it's certainly quite notable.
Isn't it also like probably one of the most, I don't know, common, it might even be a myth, but things that people would know about birds, but turtle doves have a partner for life, and if they
swans, they mate for life.
Yeah, so I guess it'd be accessible to a lot of people, you know, I've heard.
Yeah, that's right. I hadn't thought about that, actually, but you're right.
It's actually kind of special when you think about it.
Again, another little touch that's kind of unnecessary to the like this is only a side research note, but we've had quite a nice little discussion about it. It adds a lot to the area. There's a lot of that in this site. And then if you stay in the northeast area, you pick up your first wingsuit, which you can restore. But we'll get back to what you can do with that in a little bit, because we'll pick up on that again when we move on to the next island.
All right.
That's the north, kind of the northern area. There's also a southern area, which is called a relay station. And this has another quite sad little bit in it. So what you can pick up things from the tailory debris here. So again, you know, it's birds. They're going to be all brightly colored and peacocking around. So you can pick up kind of headdresses and parasols and, you know, nice little things like that. If you pick up a dream coat, an Aviancy dream coat, you can restore it and take it to Armadil, who's at the top of his tower south of Falador. If you've finished Endgame, he's back there.
He's also here in Stormguard.
He's here after you do this little mini quest or this little achievement.
Oh, okay.
The achievement is called Home is Where the God Is.
Okay.
And what you do is you restore the dream coat, you give it to him, and he says, he thanks you for it, and he says it reminds him of the coats his husband used to make.
Right.
Who's been mentioned a few times. I think he was first mentioned in Endgame, kind of in the lore drop with that. And then once you've given that to him, Armadil gives you a relic called the Ring of Solomon that was meant to protect Obi-Suth during the God Wars, but it failed. And Obi-Suth died when Forint 3 was exploded. He was one of the Aviancy who died then. But then after that, you can find Armadil at Stormguard. He kind of comes by and roosts on one of the northeastern islands, and you can have a talk with him about the place and what he thinks about what went on here. I've put the transcription in the lore notes. And I thought that was quite a sweet and quite sad inclusion.
I think that's one of the bigger pieces of Armadillian lore that people probably wanted to hear about, is that, you know, we got that little nugget on the edge about Armadil's husband at the end of Endgame, like you said, but nobody really had the explanation gone further of what happened to him or where he is now. We knew that something bad obviously happened, but now we got the full picture here.
Mm.
Bird flu.
Oh, God, Tannis.
What was that?
Bird flu.
Oh, God. No, barbecue.
Oh. God, that's even worse.
Kentucky Fried Aviancy.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
All right, I'm gonna rely on you to get this back on track. Aye, aye, aye.
The conversation you can have with Armadil here, or at the northeastern island where he's roosting, and he looks fantastic when he's roosting here on Stormguard. It really suits him and suits his design, his kind of his gold coloring. I thought he fits so nicely in there. But it's quite interesting because Armadil's the god of justice and has kind of in the past been portrayed as this. He wants peace. He's not really a big warrior. He's not really a war maker, despite what happened in Bird and the Beast, which I thought was interesting characterization for him. He ended up killing another god. Not many of the others did that. But it's kind of how he was... What was that, sorry?
I said, don't screw with the quiet ones.
Don't screw with the quiet ones. They'll turn you to stone. He says how it started off as a kind of civilian headquarters. They were trying to make things that would benefit the Aviancy and benefit people on Gilenor. And then as the God Wars went on, it became focused on weapons development, and kind of through necessity, they engaged in tech advancement for war.
And that's exactly what we see in real life too. You know, this is going to become technology, and then it becomes a war effort when the government of the day wills it to.
War was not something we sought out, but it came to us nonetheless.
Yeah,
I would not
exactly.
Sit by and see my people suffer and die at the hands of others, yet the path it took us on led to ruin regardless. Stormguard is not my greatest regret, even though it cuts deep, but it is my greatest lesson.
There you go. There you go.
So
this almost makes it makes me think of if you want peace, prepare for war.
Yeah.
As a saying.
Yeah. Which is part of Armadale's conflict, I think, as a character.
If this is going to be,
you have to do to get it.
If this is going to be a moral discussion we're going to pick up from one of the dig sites, this one perhaps is the biggest one so far that we have picked up on. So,
is this? I mean, this is kind of far out there, but is this representative of like the UK? Are we talking about world wars? Like,
I think that's a bit of a reach.
Okay.
I don't believe it's kind of something like that. I think it's more kind of Armadale's characterization has been as a peacemaker who's thrown into war against his own will. And kind of he does what he thinks he has to do, and what he thinks he has to do is the key qualifier there. And that kind of chafes against his ideals, his slightly naive ideals.
I've never been a fan of Armadale for that very reason. He's all like law and justice and, you know, all that stuff. I'm like, but you don't act it, right? It's naive. It does not how things work. And I think this one little piece of dialogue in itself already adds a lot of nuance to that character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is impressive.
Because
that's why I'm saying, because I thought this little monologue he has when you ask him about it is quite impressive. It's short, but it really shows the conflict that he goes through as a person.
This is the thing that RuneScape does, is that you think a god or character stands for one specific thing, then they really start to flesh out the lore around them, and it's an entirely different perspective, as we're seeing right here with Armadale, similar to what we saw with Zamorak after Dishonor Among Thieves.
Yeah.
Or Saradomin after, gosh, what's the name?
The Garlandia incident.
Yeah. Yeah, that Black Knight's replacement quest.
Right.
Yeah,
that one. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Death of Chivalry. Great quest. Really great quest. But yeah, I like Armadale. Unironically, I really, really like him. And this lore and this sight in the lore that came with it kind of made me like him a lot more as well.
Yeah, you're bringing me along to that path too.
Yeah. I hope he gets some more love in the future. I hope he gets some more attention.
All right.
There's another
maybe its own quest.
Maybe. There's another character you can find here on the Relay Station Island. And I'm just going to mention her briefly. And it's Famine, one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, who's come up in a couple of Halloween events.
Yeah.
I forgot she was Aviancy, but of course she would be here.
That was a bit odd seeing her there, but, you know, Aviancy kind of makes sense. Interesting.
And she doesn't
backstory.
Really say anything. You can't really interact with her. One of the achievements is if you try and give her a primal feast, and she's not very impressed about that. But you get an achievement.
What if you gave them a cooked chicken, I wonder?
Oh, God. but yeah, I just thought I'd mention that she's here. Just
which means we got three out of the four Riders of the Apocalypse now, right? We got war.
War's
we got
on
death.
War. Yeah.
We got famine.
It's just pestilence.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know anything about that one.
We ought to wait till 2021 for the introduction of that one.
Really wait a little bit for that one to die down a bit.
Yeah. All right.
So that's the Central Islands covered, I think.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, sounds good. So at this point, you get to fly. This was one of the highlights of the entire skill for me, and I don't know whether people think I'm exaggerating for that. I don't really care. Getting to the edge of this bridge and having that really awesome little transformation emote where you equip the wingsuit, and then you're flying.
Did you play the song?
It did go through my head.
I totally did. I'm like,
yeah. I mean, I personally just kind of take it away from the game from it. I love flying and flight just as a person. So this was a really huge highlight for me. Getting to look down and see the map, see Ardoin, see the mana farm really far
below.
Yes,
and that's something we need to say is that, you know, initially I thought maybe this is some generic area, but after piecing it together...
You can see Granny Potterington's house. You can see that.
Yeah, and I said, and Sirion, you and I were talking about this, and I said, you know, it's not aligned properly. And lo and behold, a couple weeks later, they rotated the box. So it was actually aligned to the right compass directions on that.
Yeah, so. It was flipped the first time for the first couple of weeks, but it's now the right north-south orientation.
Which is absolutely amazing when you think of it. And, I mean, hopefully, I wonder if that would persist if you had low view range turned on.
I don't know.
I think so. It's just a skybox. So there's no geometry back there, right?
Okay.
It's literally...
paper, really.
Yeah. Like, basically, whenever you are in the world of RuneScape, you are always in sort of a sphere, like a little ball around you. And on the inside of the ball, there's basically a texture, like a painting, and that's your skybox. And that's always there, no matter your view distance.
Yeah.
All right.
I loved this little inclusion. It's just...
It's funny. Flying really surpassed my expectations. I was like... looking at the edge, I was like, okay, I'm going to click this and it's going to teleport me to the other place with the fancy animation. It's like, no, it's literally like a whole different layer. And, you know, I was impressed with, how well it feels and the animation. The animation work on it is done so good. You know, it's a really technical feat. And this is like one of these things that, you know, it makes Stormguard stand out as dig site, right? It's the feature of Stormguard. And I think each of the dig sites sort of has its own really unique identifying feature. And I think the flying is the one that sells it for me for Stormguard.
I really want to know, kind of from a technical point of view, how difficult it was to do the mapping between the islands, because it's three-dimensional. Kind of how you travel between them and how you deal with different people's flight paths. Like, how hard was that to put together, or how did they even put it together? Because I think it's quite new to the game.
Yeah, because previously you'd only be able to walk on ground.
Like, is it the same as walking on ground where you have kind of the set limits, or is it more?
I would think so.
Yeah, I think literally they split the map in two. Well, it's all ground, right? Whether you're on the island or in the sky, it's all just walkable, basically. It's just that you can't get from the ground to the air bit because there's blocking in the way.
Mm.
The only way you can sort of transition from one area to the other is, it's like an agility shortcut, except for on the other side of the agility shortcut, your walking animation is replaced with a flying animation.
Yes, exactly.
That's how I expect it to be done.
There's
nowhere where you can like fly under a bridge that you can also walk over. Like there's no crisscrossing of that. It's, if you look at it, it's all still, you can map it all to a flat plane.
Mm.
So,
still linear.
Yeah. It's still super, super impressive and done super smoothly to hide the fact. But,
it's funny what I remember when we were talking about Infernal Source. I think we had a brief discussion about the warp markers. I found them so helpful for navigating around Stormguard when flying around, because it really makes it obvious where you're going.
You sort of lose the sense of direction with no geometry to hit yourself against.
Is you don't really know where you're ending up.
I just loaded it up with low view range, and you can still see the ground down below on there.
That's cool. That's really cool.
You didn't trust me, Shane?
Well, no, I wanted to do that, and I wanted to see how it would perform on mobile, because I haven't gone there yet on mobile.
Nice.
And, you know, because, you know, I live in an era right now where the mobile client works better for me than the macOS client. But that's a topic for a different time.
Oh, nice. But flight looks fantastic. You go past this while you're exploring around, you go past this weird looking gravitational core, and this is what's holding the site up and together. And it's the beginnings of the introduction to advanced fantasy tech, which you then come across later on. And you start to pick up in the lore books you discover kind of from here on in. So I think, yeah, the next main island is the Northwest R&D site. So let me just land that. I'm in game at the moment, just flying around.
All right.
If you give me a couple of seconds just to land.
And this is also where we get one of our... Do you want to do a geography first and then cover the lore books, or do you want to cover the lore books as we move through each island?
Let's cover the lore books as we go through each island, right? Because yeah, you pick them up in the different excavation sites. So there's two you can pick up kind of on these levels. The first one's called The Spy Who Loved Metal, and it's a three-parter chronicling the efforts of a spy to steal different kinds of metal from the other god factions in the God Wars. So I think the point of this one is to add in some... I approach these lore books thinking about what's the point? What's this adding to the lore? What's this adding to the skill? Why are they talking about this? And with this one, it is to illustrate the tensions or alliances or just how the different factions are viewing each other at a particular point in the God Wars. It's kind of a snapshot of the conflict or lack of it. So in this case, there's kind of a tenuous alliance with Saradomin because some Ikovians have been invited to the Dominion Games at Everlight, which is kind of the parallel to the Olympics, which is quite an interesting thing because they are kind of working together but not really trusting each other. So it's kind of a surface-level alliance. Armdil and Bandos have never got on.
Nope.
We know that well. So the spy posed, interestingly, as a Saradominus supporter to get into the Warforge to steal Warforge bronze, because we know that Saradomin and Zamorak both bought mercenaries off Bandos for their own conflict. So we know that they were in contact, even if they weren't actually allied. And then the spy infiltrates the source, the infernal source, as a cultist to gather hellfire metal. Kind of a bit of talk about demons there as well.
Who, I just want to ask this question. Who would have ever thought that it would have been the Aviancies who would have been running the spy program?
I mean, the little birds, right? Little birds are like the spies.
Well, I mean, but do we know if they're little birds or if they're all big birds?
They're big. Aviancy. Okay, yeah. This is a kind of a side note. Aviancy are fucking terrifying, and bleep me out if you think that's, like, inappropriate.
Well, but yeah, and see, that's the thing why I was wondering. I've never seen a little Aviancy.
You do get a couple of them, and that Howl, actually, we'll get to his concept art at the end, but Howl's a little one. But they are 6 foot tall, predatory, man-sized birds. They're mostly carnivores. And they're just flying around. Can you imagine how scary that would be?
Oh, yeah.
If you're just out and about in the third age, you're like a farmer, you're a peasant, you're looking after your sheep. And this 6 foot tall peregrine falcon style thing, like, look at Armadil.
Yeah,
he's a hawk, he's a hunter.
There's actually a theory that back in the day there was a bird that, and this was a long, long time ago, we're talking many thousands of years ago, that inhabited New Zealand, that was of similar size, that actually preyed on small children.
I think that was the precursor to the roc legend, as in ROC, roc.
Yes.
These enormous eagles.
Yes, exactly.
Similar kind of thing. Like, when you think about that, how scary are Aviancy?
Right.
I mean, the Australians lost the war against emu, so...
Yeah, and they can't even fly.
So, yeah, no, that's fair enough.
And it's important to remember also that birds can be flightless birds.
Yeah.
Too.
So. Can we take a second to appreciate the reference in this lore book, though? To a great... Yeah, it's a James Bond movie, isn't it?
Yeah, The Spy Who Loved Me.
The Spy Who Loved Me, yeah.
There's a lot of those. There's one reference later on that kind of hit me like a sack of bricks when I was doing this notes. I thought, how did I not notice this first time?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, The Spy Who Loved Metal is a reference to A Spy Who Loved Me, which is an Ian Fleming 007 book.
Yeah.
But yeah, on this little book also introduced the idea of they're gathering metal for something. We don't know what it is yet, but that's kind of laying the groundwork for a bit of the later storytelling. So that's that lore book. You can also start picking up a second one from the Northwest R&D site called A Study in Aether. And this is where Howl is properly introduced. And Howl, I think, is a reference to Howl's Moving Castle. So Howl's Floating Workshop, Howl's Moving Castle. I think that's the reference tie-in there. And he's this mysterious, described as an alchemist. I'd characterize him as a scientist and inventor, but I don't think science is really a thing in Gilenor. So they would use alchemy, which historically is the correct word for what science used to be before about, I think 1830s was when science became a thing. So yeah, he's an alchemist. Yeah, and you get a series of different project notes talking about what he's been working on and kind of more information about Stormguard and how it's protected and what they're doing here.
I just love the names for all of these ones, and these are all different pages. Each page details a different one, and I'm just going to run through them and I'll let you talk about the details, but I just love the names of the projects. Project Blackfire, Projects Night Howl and Hawkeye, Project Karina, Project Talon, Project Woodpecker.
Yeah, they're great code names, aren't they?
Yeah.
So yeah, each one talks about a slightly different thing. So Blackfire is talking about an explosive lance. So you've got this kind of spear that's got an explosive on the end. You fire it, you stab someone, and it explodes when they hit them.
I want that.
Pretty nasty, yeah. It'd be a cool weapon in game.
Yeah. I like my weapons of war. Tannis, you probably know that.
Yeah, it also talks about how Stormguard's actually protected and how it's been hidden all this time. It's got this cloaking storm cloud and this electrical barrier.
Okay. We just have to stop for a minute because there's two things here that need to be talked about with this. The first one is that there is that electrical barrier around the edge of Stormguard that if you attempt to fly through it, you can't fly through all the, I guess you could call them, I want to say pillars, but they're not exactly sitting on the ground. They're floating in the sky. You need to upgrade your wingsuit for that to be able to fly through those. And the second thing is the cloud that you just described, that's the same thing that was covering Anachronia, except when we passed through that one, it took us through time.
Oh, because
it was a big cloud with an electrical storm.
That's interesting.
That we were building the Stormbreaker for, to go to Anachronia.
Did you actually go through time to get to Anachronia?
That's the sense I got. And whenever I was
under the impression that the needle just reverted the entire place back to its state. Many, many, many times ago. So I did not link that to the storm.
See, I thought I didn't think it actually was to do with the dinosaurs, as it were.
Yeah, and another reason I think that it was linked with the storm and why it is some kind of time issue associated with it is because of the temporal distortions that appear whenever you activate a pillar or a totem on Anachronia.
Oh, right.
Oh, I haven't gotten that far yet.
And to take it one step further, when you activate those totems, the skybox and texturing of Anachronia changes to what a destroyed version of it would look like.
Oh, maybe that's something to look out for then in the near future.
Yeah,
that's exciting.
Or maybe we will get that quest.
Wow. Yeah, I'll make
those are the same temporal distortions that appeared in Desperate Times.
Times.
Yeah. Anyways.
I wonder if that's anything to do with the cloud around Stormguard. There's no mention of any kind of anything to do with time around Stormguard, but maybe there's a connection
but
with
the cloud. But the cloud and electrical is what ticked me off on that path. But anyways, continue. Project Night Owl and Hawkeye.
So yeah, Project Night Owl and Hawkeye, they were quite interesting for me to read. It's basically the development of flight goggles and telescopes that look beyond visible light. So Hal, being an alchemist, he says he adds fire to a telescope to give infrared vision, to give looking at heat. He says adding air gives the ability to see through solid objects. And adding quintessence, which is kind of a classical fifth element. You got air, earth, fire, water, and quintessence.
I thought ether.
It's the same thing. It's ether. Yeah. It's the same thing.
I see.
Which was kind of thought of before the idea of a vacuum was known.
Yeah.
It was thought that space, or the cosmic space above Earth, was filled with quintessence or ether. And it's kind of characterized in Gyllenor as this kind of magical element. So you've got the four natural elements and a magical one. But yeah, that gives night vision. So you've got a nice bit of fantasy science here and kind of fantasy spectroscopy almost, which is awesome. I like that. Kind of high tech stuff that's very, very different to what we've got in game at the moment. Really ahead of its time.
And you got to wonder what it's going to be used for. And, you know, this might be a red herring, but you remember in the archaeology trailer, it ends with the slogan, "Dig deep, war is coming."
Yeah, what are we going to find here?
Exactly.
What are we going to use later on? Yeah, then look to Project Carina, which is talking about the development of the wingsuits, using quintessence to form a mobile power source, which I kind of interpreted to mean a battery.
This is starting to sound, because I know where this is going. This is going to ancient invention. It's almost starting to sound like quintessence or ether has the role in all this invention stuff as what anima does for invention nowadays.
See, it could be like that, because I don't think anima was accessible in the same way it is now in the Sixth Age.
Exactly, because the anima released when Guffix died.
Yeah, when the rifts opened.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this was what was used in as the power source before then.
Exactly. Or maybe it is the same thing, just by a different name. That
could be.
There's actually no telling.
Yeah, it's unclear at the moment.
Well, then why would they call it a fifth element? I mean, I guess you could say that. But anyways, yes.
Yeah. So yeah, Project Carina and Project Talon about developing the prosthetic wings. Project Talon is developing them for combat, which kind of Hal sounds a little bit reluctant to do. He says, "I try to explain that the suit is best suited to provide mobility to the less fortunate and is not suitable for combat functionality." He reassured me that it was only for defensive purposes. So kind of, again, that reluctance to apply civilian, the kind of medical prosthetics to war.
Yeah, and we're going to build them, but they're going to be for defensive purposes only.
Yeah, it's like, oh yeah, we're not actually going to attack anyone with this.
And we don't know if they did, do we?
I mean, we know that Avianci were combatants in the Third Age.
Yeah.
We know that they did attack. They weren't passive people there. Armadil brought them to Gyllenor to fight.
And I imagine they did use these, because, you know, we don't exactly know how that would have appeared. And, you know, thinking about it, this is probably why they mentioned a remastered God Wars Dungeon 1 is one of the updates they could have done this year, is because now knowing this and what we know about all the different factions, you could weave more lore into that.
Mm. And that's a nice little segue into the God Wars Dungeon, because the next part is directly relevant.
It's almost like I did that intentionally.
Yeah. This is where they talk about the metals that were gathered in The Spy Who Loved Metal, so in the previous lore book, using them to forge the Aetherium alloy, which will be used to create a new weapon, one that can even harm a god. So this is the original Godsword. This is a big lore tie-in here. This was the site where the first Godsword was forged. And no, Godswords in game now are kind of quite common melee weapons. Like, they're kind of the first high-level melee weapon you get.
Yeah.
But in the story, the first one was made kind of towards the end-ish of the Third Age, specifically to kill Zamorak.
Yeah, and we haven't got there yet, us level-wise, but at level 112, there's something called the prototype Godsword that you excavate from Stormguard.
Yeah. And the prototype Godbow, I think, as well.
Yeah.
So this was the research facility that came up with the weapon to kill Zamorak, who was kind of threatening to destroy everything by that point. But what happened was whenever I think by this point, Bandos, Armadil, and Saradomin had kind of loosely banded together against Zamorak because they had to try and stop him somehow. Armadil's scientists made the weapon and tried to deliver it to their allies. Zamorak heard about it and kind of his forces disrupted this. And they all retreated into the mountains northwest of Forinthry, started fighting, didn't stop. Eventually all four armies turned against each other, and that's how the God Wars dungeon came to be. So this is the direct tie-in to the first God Wars dungeon.
And again, sort of this great, isn't it? Like, you start with the Ekovian stuff, which leads us into something completely new, and it goes in a completely different direction with this metal and the ether, and we never heard about all of this. Mm. And they somehow make it come full circle to the God Swords and the God Wars dungeon,
yeah,
putting us right back, literally, with both our feet on the ground.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's, if you think about it, I find it hard to believe that when the first God Wars dungeon came about, that all this lore existed.
It probably didn't.
So having that all tie in and tied up really, really nicely, you know, we talk about how amazing the skill is, both from like a mechanical perspective and storytelling perspective, but purely looking at the world building and, you know, making this all make sense, there was a lot of effort put into this. Like, this is not something you do for free. Like, a lot of time goes into this.
There was probably a lot of iterations of this and a lot of story brainstorming sessions that went into this to make it so self-consistent. And that, to me, is a good fantasy world. Like, obviously in fantasy you can do whatever you want because it's fantasy, but the world you create has to be self-consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise it's never going to stick. And
verisimilitude is super important. Like, even if you don't go into all the details, like, I bet you that even the people who wrote this don't know all the details of this story, right? But they made it in such a way that, you know, even if there's gaps, and even if there's, like, you know, lore gaps or things that are inconsistent, as long as they're not super blatant, we are willing to become part of this fantasy and forgive them for this. And that's
the suspension of disbelief, kind of tricking the reader, or in this case the player, into suspending their disbelief for long enough and to such an extent,
yes,
that they accept your world.
Yes.
It's the hardest, mm-hmm, part of fantasy writing.
And, you know,
they do it well here.
Yeah, they do it pretty well in this skill, which is just,
and
like,
while we were talking about Aetherium, remember there's also an Aetherium outfit that you can get from the Artisan's Workshop at 100% spec.
Aetherium armor.
Yeah. That was
It
was one of the rejected designs of what Masterwork could have looked like, so they put it in as a cosmetic after the fact. It'd be interesting to see how it all kind of ties together with Stormguard.
Yeah. That's the study in Aether. Don't know whether you want to talk about that a little bit more, if I can hop on to the next.
Yeah, let's move on to the next one.
Next part. So the next one you get, kind of if you're going up the levels, it's basically specialist research from here on in until you get to Howl's Workshop. So if you go to the Southwest R&D site and you've got the right wingsuit, I think it's the level 3 wingsuit, you can kind of fly around the back of it and find this war golem arm kind of suspended in midair. Huge arm. And you can examine it to discover the Ethereum Giant, which I think is an Iron Giant reference. Brilliant film, by the way. Makes me cry every single time. And it says, yeah, the Stormguard Citadel appears to have been some sort of secret testing facility, not solely for weapons, but no doubt that during the God Wars, weapon development was a primary concern. So, yeah, we know Armadillians made golems. We know that they use them in battle. And golems are kind of traditionally animated, inanimate objects. I don't want to say they're robots, because that's slightly different. They're not robots. They kind of come from Jewish folklore, and they're traditionally made of clay. Interpreted here as huge, semi-sentient, mechanical things.
Yeah, and we had one of those in the past in the desert.
Yes, the golem at Uzza.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's an Armadillian golem or not.
No, I would think not.
Yeah, but we know that this was something that they specialize in, the Armadillians specialize in. But look at the size of it. It's huge. Kind of gets a hint of the kind of scale of the research and the weapons facilities they were trying to build here. Massive things. I'm just trying to compare my player model size against it. It's easily, you know, 6 or 7 times as tall as you are as a character, and that's just the arm. Like, whew, that must have been huge, like the full thing. But that's all you find on the Southwest R&D site. The next research is at the Night Guard Tower, and I know we talked a bit about that previously, the Night Guard and the Day Guard.
Yep.
This gives you a little bit more fluff about them. So the Day Guard and Night Guard Keshik warriors were seemingly stationed at Stormguard, in part to protect its scientific inhabitants should the external lightning cloud shielding fail, but also to test out various experimental weapons. So kind of that, there's your explicit lore conclusion about who they were and what they did.
I want to know what the weapons were.
So yeah, so they were briefly mentioned. One of them was briefly mentioned in the explosive lance, like Project Blackfire.
Yeah.
But I assume there were many other different weapons, you know, that were being developed and experimented with here.
Mm-hmm.
Would be cool to unlock some of them, but don't know if that'll ever happen.
Yeah, and, you know, what kind of ramifications that would have in the like.
Yeah. But yeah, once you've got all that research, you can go up a level. Sorry. So if you fly back around to where the gravitational core is, you can interact with one of the shards, and it takes you up into Howell's workshop.
I think you need another Jerash for that.
Yeah, you have to unlock a
Stormguard one.
Yeah.
One of the research gives it to you. I forget what the exact name is on there for it, but you can get it without needing to do any excavating at the 95 site, because that's where it comes from. I don't remember the name of it, unfortunately, but it's relatively easy to get. Site. Yeah. But
so yeah, up here you get into the kind of the peak of the skill, which is Ancient Invention.
Howl's Workshop
and Ancient Invention.
And, you know, for people who haven't seen
Shane,
it,
I've just seen you in game.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm doing it all on mobile, by the way.
Nice.
But for people who haven't got to Stormguard yet, as you train in Stormguard, you do get these blueprint fragments, and there's also some that are flying around that you can pick up and whatnot, and those are what you need to do or need to have to unlock all the various ancient invention blueprints for like the gizmos and the tools and whatnot. So
yeah.
And there's also a chance to unlock tradable and untradable ones, so kind of the same way the agility tokens on Anachronia work, but
the codex pages
yeah,
and the unlocks from player imports where you can make tradable and untradable versions of the armor and weapons and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So same kind of thing there.
I'm just trying to get a good shot of it here and show that off. But, you know, Howl's Workshop. And
yeah.
It was a bit surprising to me that this was unlocked through a research, because I think this was the first time that something in the skill was unlocked directly through a research. And, of course, talking about ancient invention here.
Yeah. So you need to do Ancient Invention and Back to the Drawing Board and Howling Man are the two pieces of – are the two special research you have to do to unlock this area.
You have to do research for Infernal Source as well to get to all the way down.
Oh,
you have right. to do the research to find out you can use a Chaos Star, I think.
Get down to the demon at the bottom. You're right. Yeah. I forgot about that. My bad.
And I think there is another one, which is the... can I spoil Warforge?
Yeah.
Yeah, go for it. Spoilers, so just spoilers.
To get past the throne, Bandos' throne, that's also a piece of research.
Ah, okay. I wonder if... Oh, yeah, and Everlight as well, actually thinking about it.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Okay, we were completely wrong.
Hey, we got one for each, and I was wrong. Excellent.
Probably the Zarosian one, but I haven't got quite that far yet.
Yep.
But yeah, so you crack the cipher, you crack Howl's cipher. If you have a look at the pieces of paper on the floor, there's things that are taken from Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks. So you can see the wingsuit and the Vitruvian man, but it's an Aviancy. And even the tank, Leonardo da Vinci's little tank design. So he's obviously that's the inspiration and the model here. And obviously Leonardo da Vinci wrote in a cipher quite famously. So yeah, there's another influence there.
And then there's also the things you can discover on the wall if you examine the wall with the blueprints.
Yeah, I just want to talk about these briefly because you do get a little bit of character talking to yourself to reveal exposition. Which I thought was a little bit clumsy, but I suppose they had to do it somehow.
But I mean, what would be more fitting in unlocking invention-y related things than talking to yourself?
Exactly, I suppose.
I know Sirion talks to himself all the time when he's making things.
Am I?
That's just programmers for you. but yeah, the experimental aether reactor, which is the relic I think you were talking about. Oh, no, wait, it's a different one you were talking about. But yeah, the ether reactor gives you conservation of energy ability, which is the ability to regain 10% adrenaline after you've used an ultimate ability.
Mm-hmm.
The golem framework, which is part of the Krez framework relic, which gives you divine conversion, which is the one we were talking about causing a problem earlier. And this, I think, had the... Oh no, it's the next one that I think had the clumsiest line in the whole site. The subtle blade. This was the big reference that kind of hit me when I was writing this up. It's a reference to Philip Pullman's series, Northern Lights. The second book is called The Subtle Knife. And this is a knife that can cut through realities and enable you to pass between worlds. And here it's used to unlock the ability to teleport without using runes. Which is quite an interesting one. I'm definitely going to try and unlock that one because it could be very useful.
I think that is 112, if I remember correctly.
112, that's one I'm a little way off then still. But yeah, this one includes the line, thanks to my World Guardian status. I think this is talking about Guthix's sword, and that was a bit... Oh.
Yeah, there was a whole debacle about that when that came in.
That was a bit of a fudged line, but yeah. I'm going to leave that just a minor quibble. But yeah, those are the three relics you can unlock for doing this last bit of discovery. And then from there you've got Ancient Invention at the drafting bench.
Which we've talked about at length on the PVM version of the show. Just how it makes so many traits easier to get. You know, the old meta for much cheaper. And, you know, even Hone 6 you can now get if you're a skiller through this in a much cheaper way than you used to be able to get Hone 5. So it's good for all involved.
And from there, the literal pinnacle of the site, that is the end of Stormguard. So you've got this lovely kind of going up through the sky. You finish up at the workbench.
It's a nice sort of opposite to all the other sites where you dig deeper.
Yeah, yeah.
And here you sort of go up instead. I mean, I guess Everlight is sort of weird, but, you know, it is sort of... It's a nice opposite where they really...
It's a really original idea to introduce a site that's in the sky.
Yeah, yeah.
I really like that.
And that's what they said was going to be the whole point of the archaeology skills, that it just wouldn't be digging up old dusty things. It would be discovering new areas and methods of, you know, fantasy. And, you know, I think what you can see here is some of this concept art that you posted, and we went through this as well on launch, but the artist's renditions of what Stormguard would have looked like in the Third Age. Mm-hmm. Absolutely majestic.
Yeah, the two, the first, there's three I've put in here. The first one and the last one are from the cutscenes in game, where you have Tony narrating over the top, kind of giving the opening and the closing. So these are official art that's in game. So yeah, you've got the first one where this is what Stormguard looked like when at its peak, the more detailed concept art. And the last one is Howl. You can see him, the little owl figure on his perch with the golem.
It to me, looking at that last picture, right, gives me, if you look at sort of more trope-ish fantasy, that would have been a gnome. Like, gnomes are generally the tinkerers and all that stuff. So it's a nice little departure from that trope and finding a new role there, because gnomes in RuneScape are very different than gnomes usually are. Like, gnomes are usually like the inventors and the tinkerers, while in RuneScape they're sort of really close to nature and close to the anima and all that stuff. So
they're kind of one of the original Gothixian races.
Yeah, yeah. So one thing that I noticed and I spotted at some point is I'm not there in game right now, so it's hard to explain exactly. But I know on the first island, there's, at some point, there's something you can click, like on a wall or like a something, and looks like a ghost.
Oh, the Avianti spirits.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I haven't actually managed to uncover this yet, and I probably should have done.
Huh. I haven't even seen them. Please do elaborate.
Yeah, Siren, have you got any more on that?
Not from the top of my head. I know I can just... I was just excavating. I was like, hey, this looks like a clickable thing. Let's click it. And a Avianti spirit showed up and...
Oh, I've got it here. Yeah. It's an achievement called Abana Resting Here for a While.
Yeah.
There are 5 Avianti spirits within the Citadel. In very small kind of urns. Very, very tiny, looking by the screenshots.
They are really hard to find, yeah.
And you free them, and you'd get to talk to them.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they have super interesting conversation, like in dialogue, but yeah, it's like another little thing. And that's so cool about all these sites. Like, there's so many tiny little things that, you know, most players probably will run past and not even care, but, you know, the small number of players that spots it and spots the depth, it's worth it, I think, because it really gives that feeling of there being more to it than there is.
Mm.
Yeah, I legit did not see that. Interesting. I'll have to go back and pick that up. Pick those up. So it was just on the main island after you came in, where the excavation sites are?
Two on the main island, one at the Night Guard Tower, one at the Day Guard Tower, and one at the southwestern island. Oh, they're tiny urns. Yeah, I've just found one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and you unlock a spirit. Oh, okay.
Uh-oh, that doesn't sound good.
So the spirits... So I've just unlocked Kriegal. You talk to him and he says Usun, which I assume is his partner.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what these are. These are the spirits, and they say their partner's names. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's sad. And then they vanish.
Yeah.
Oh, bless.
Yeah, I find it impressive how much depth and dimensions they added to all this storytelling.
Yeah. I find it interesting how much they added on top of the critical path.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the core path of the skill that they put through it and all like the basic mechanics, but there is so much, I suppose, I don't know whether this is the right term for it, but I call it fluff. Mm. So you fluff it up, you make it more interesting, you add the layers and the colors and the stuff that...
And that's how it used to be back in the day. You know, the books used to be optional, all the exam texts that were added to all the new areas and all the new quests, you know, that's where the first lorehounds, like, came into play, right? Like, people would go and examine all the texts, and there was so much hidden lore to be found there already. And then they sort of lost that for a long time, where, you know, like, Fifth Dinners, to me, is sort of the saddest part of this journey, where you cannot examine all, like, you can hardly examine anything in Fifth Dinners.
Yeah.
It's all just geometry.
It's all and
yeah, exactly. And it feels, and that's what it's one of the reasons why to this day I do not like that city. It looks pretty, but, and it has a lot of cool training methods, but, you know, it feels flat. It feels, you know, there's no depth to it, that it feels like there's something missing there. And that is something they really avoided here. And like every, I mean, that's what the quest is about, but each of the dig sites feels like it has a history to it. It feels like it is centuries old, and it tells a story beyond what we see at first, if we want to look past, you know, the facade of what we see at, if we just look at it.
And that's something the game has been lacking in years. And
yeah,
that's why we said when this came out, it's been one of the most RuneScape-y updates that the game has ever had, which, you know, everybody absolutely loved having. So, and you know, you just hit it out of the park. And I feel like whenever we do these lore episodes, I learn something more about this from the discussion. So hopefully this has been useful to our listeners here. Is there anything else you guys want to talk about with Stormguard here?
I can't wait until I hit 95 and you know, get to uncover this all myself. You know, it, like, I've picked up parts of this story to, you know, other players and just seeing and hearing things, and you can't really not be spoiled here, I think. Like, it's such a big deal, which is why I was fine coming on this episode, but you know, I still look forward to actually experiencing this and finding all these new areas. And
yeah, I would recommend, like, for everyone who's doing this skill and everyone who's still doing it, I know a lot of people have finished it by now, and even if people have rushed through it to their 200 mil, go back and take your time and just be in the environments, turn the music on, and kind of let yourself just be there for a while, because so much work has gone into creating these places and making them feel so real and deep, and there is so much stuff in them. Like, just take your time.
Are you suggesting we make an Iron Man and do it again?
Why not? Why not? There's no combat. What's the loss? But like, even just, it's, if you're a lorehound like me and you enjoy the storytelling side of things, it's a very rewarding skill to do.
Yeah.
Like Sirian said, there's so many touches that make hanging around and investigating and just kind of poking around in the corners worth it.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. And I think sort of for me, I've avoided using too many guides. I have to admit, I'm not entirely guideless.
Mostly.
But I try doing most of it blind and doing the puzzles myself. Also, like, sort of doing an Iron Man mode, which it really means that I am uncovering this as I go, which is the only way you get to sort of experience this alongside your character, I think.
Mm.
And
put aside the efficiency scape, put aside the optimization, and just enjoy the experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Discovering the game.
I mean, at some point, like when you hit like mid level, you have to start thinking about, you know, what am I going to grind to hit the next milestone? Yeah. Like, it's not entirely, you know, you can just do that. But still, I try to mix up the environments. I try to just sort of focus on having fun. And I've fallen behind at this point on my level on most of the people here. And, you know, I don't think I care.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
Tannis,
I think for a final note on... Oh, sorry, Tannis, if you want to...
Tannis, you want to jump in at all on this? Final notes, anything that Stormguard...
I'm looking forward to going back when I am done with Warforge. So, looking forward to that. And I love these lore discussions because I learn so much because I just don't get a lot when I'm going through it and stuff, so... I really appreciate these kind of discussions we do.
I'm glad to hear it.
I think it is really easy to miss all this stuff because it is so integrated with the lore. But once everything clicks, for me it's these episodes specifically are like, oh
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's good discussing it too.
That's how that all fits together, and you know, it makes me only appreciate the skill even more.
Precisely. Makes me want to go back and push harder to 98 and beyond, probably. All right.
Before we finish Stormguard, I want to give a shout out to one of Mod Jack's lore drops. And this is a Google document that was put into the official lore channels of the Discord a while ago, quite a long time ago now.
Oh, is this the one from RuneFest all those years back?
This is the one from RuneFest 2017, and it goes into a lot more detail about Avianci military culture. And I really recommend reading it because it is discussing more the influence of the Mongol Empire and Central Asian military tradition on Avianci. And more about how Armadil is viewed by his own people, which I find so fascinating. Just in summary, Armadil has a really unique position amongst the Ascended Gods. So Saradomin is really, really old and is kind of an uncontested god of the Iceni and kind of humans as well. Zamorak is obviously the god of the Majorat and the demons. Bandos is this sadistic bully boy god of all the ogre-type races, kind of uncontested. Armadil is not the god of the Avianci in any way, shape, or form. He is very young. He's kind of literally, and I think mentally, he's, you know, quite naive and quite, not innocent, but I think you know what I mean there. And many of the Avianci don't follow him. He is a god amongst the Avianci. He is definitely not a god of them. They have entirely separate religion and spirituality and religious practice that has nothing to do with him. And he barely has any control over the Avianci whatsoever during the Third Age, which I thought is a really interesting dynamic and quite unique amongst the ascended beings that we have in RuneScape. So yeah, definitely going to give that a read. I think it's considered canon until contradicted by in-game lore. So right. Kind of bear that in mind. If anything in-game has happened later on since this document was published, take what happens in-game as canon. But most of it, I think, still stands. So yeah, I put a link to that in there. Definitely go and give it a read. It's got some really nice juicy details in there.
Yeah, I remember being at the lore talk at RuneFest where they talked about this. It sounds like there's more in the doc than they dropped there, but it was a super interesting talk. I really, really enjoyed that. It was a shame it wasn't a tent outside, but
yeah, it was kind of shoved off to the side, wasn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't. That was a bit disappointing, but you know, I think it was a great talk, and I'll definitely go and give that a read.
Yeah, it's also got some details about Zamorak and Saradomin forces in the same age. So there's more information in there as well that I think I'll refer back to whenever we get to Everlight. But yeah, that's all I had to say about Stormguard. I love this site so much. I really like Armadil. I think he's my second choice god after Zamorak, if I had to choose. there's so much work that's gone into this, and I feel like we've finally got a solid base of lore about Avianci now and about Armadil, which we didn't have previously. So if nothing else, that's fantastic.
All right. I agree. 110% on that. We are running a little bit later than we thought we were. So I'm going to go through the updates this week on our World Cup of Quests, and then following that, I'll just make brief mention of the audio showcase and some very good news regarding charitable efforts that we have. So since we've last talked about the World Cup of Quests here at RSBNB Update, we've had two more votes go up. We had Fate of the Gods versus One Small Favor. And this one had started on the weekend, and Fate of the Gods won 70.2 to 29.8% on this
one. Thank God.
Yes.
I voted for One Small Favor.
I know, and we had quite the lively discussion in Clan Quest about this.
Say again what quests were up against each other? One Small Favor against
Fate of the Gods.
Fate of the Gods.
Yep.
How can you vote for One Small Favor? How?
Because that's what
is one of the best quests they have ever done.
Because One Small Favor to me is a representation of what RuneScape is and should be. It is cheeky. It is full of British humor. It is random. And it is not one of those many world-altering, changing events which are getting a bit tiresome at this point. You know, it...
I disagree so hard, but okay, well, we'll argue about this later.
I think I'm about to be kicked out of a clan, but you know, let's move forward.
Oh, I'm really angry.
Next was Dragon Slayer versus the Gower Quest.
Oh, but that's an obvious one.
This one is obvious. Dragon Slayer, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Dragon Slayer is winning 83.6 to 16.4.
Good.
Yeah, I would hope so.
And I voted for Dragon Slayer on this one. It's the one I hope that wins at the end of the day.
That's fair. Yep.
Just because it's, I mean, Desert Treasure I wanted in there, but that one got beat, unfortunately, at the beginning by While Guthix Sleeps.
Oh, yeah, I can understand that. Yeah. While Guthix Sleeps is up there.
It's too bad that it had to go up against... Well, Guthix Sleeps, Desert Treasure, that is, but that's the way it is.
Should it be the final? Yeah. Right? Desert Treasure versus Well, Guthix Sleeps?
Yeah.
Sounds like a great
But they
like
were in the same
final.
Seed, so. All right. Also, this week we had a live stream with Mod Porky and Mod ENT and Surma. Regarding the audio team, I'm not going to go too much into the details of these. And in fact, if this is interesting to you, I'd actually recommend listening to it because they went through a lot of the audio sound effects and cues that have been set up on here. I'll just nail off a couple of quick tidbits from this. Mod ENT was the first external hire at Jagex. He's been there for 18 years.
Yeah, he's one of the IG.
Yeah.
I think Sea Shanty 2 is his fault. So, he deserves more recognition as a mod. Like so many
he really
of the
does. He really
of the
does.
Iconic tracks in RuneScape are all from him.
Yeah.
And he's been there for a very long time. So give him more love.
Their sound library has a few hundred thousand sounds in it that they're able to use and manipulate to build whatever they need in game, and they keep adding to it. In general, when they have a skill, 16 sounds are grouped together for an animation, like woodcutting or archaeology, for example, and it's randomized which one plays. There's also the talk of a giant pinecone sound library that they were able to use to make sound like huge monsters. Then they talked a bit about producing of Everlight, the Everlight Underground soundtrack, and how about a third of the sounds used to produce that came from Ian's synthesizer, which is this, you know, otherworldly looking piece of audio equipment for that. And, you know, you find this very interesting. Of course, give a listen to all this. They have some sound effects samples on there. They added in Adobe Audition making a very good choice there. I do have to say so myself on that. That's what we use for the podcast here too. Then they ended, of course, with the famous question, is the sound of Andrew Gower's mom frying bacon still the default cooking sound? And no, that was removed a long time ago because it was a large sound and they'd much rather use the synthesizer because the synthesizer sounds are much tinier. So
that's one of the fun facts about RuneScape though, isn't it?
Yeah,
like the cooking sound used to be this guy's mom cooking bacon. It's adorable.
Then there was also a brief discussion about communication, which I think if we talk about that, we'll be here for another hour. But the official line that came from this was that they're aware that there is a desire for more communication. They can't comment right now, and progress is being made internally.
That's as much as we can hope for at this stage.
Yeah, and I mean, given the news we talked about last week, kind of makes sense why. So we're still waiting for the new fella to be introduced with a mod name. All right, and final piece of news, RS, Old School, and Jagex in total have donated more than $250,000 to charity over the past few months here. And this was in a recent video update that was posted by Mod Pips. And, you know, I think we can all pat ourselves on the back because this goes to their charitable partners, the Princess Trust, CPSL Mind, and Rise Above the Disorder. And they break it down based on event. So for the mental health event from the 18th to the 24th of May, they raised £104,000 from that 1 week-long event. From the drop, when they ran that, 34.5. The Old School 1v1 tournament charity, £6,000. Old School charity Dead Man Mode tournament, £25,000. And Old School Level Up for Charity on April 29th, another 34.5 for a grand total of £204,000, plus the initial £100,000 that Jagex was going to donate for the total of 204.
That's awesome.
And, yeah, that's brilliant.
And people always wonder, you know, what does Mental Health Awareness Week do for us and what does it do for their charities? Well, here's the answer, £104,000 for a 1 week-long event, which is substantial when you think about it. So, well done, everyone.
Well
done.
As well, so that's really good news.
Alrighty, we do have a listener discussion question that we do have time for before we start ramping down. But before we do that, I'll just take a moment to thank our listeners for this episode and so much more. This week I'd like to thank Brock H., Cameron, Cass, CGB900, Christian S., Diana, Jade Gizmo, Jade W., James W., Jason S., Joe M., John P., and Jelly. Boy, we have a lot of J names in here, don't we? Kyle, Mr. Ling, Nora, Our Memories, Rastafa, Ricky A., Rippeth, Steve D., The Naked Captain, The Lion, Tom V., Zant, and Zez. Thank you all of you for your support. It truly does mean the world to us. And if this sounds at all interesting to you, just head over to patreon.com/rsbnb. And this is where I get to spill a little bit about what the monthly bit's going to look like this month. It's going to be a little bit different than normal in that it's not going to be one contiguous episode. What you can expect through the remainder of June is you can expect a series of sit-down, one-on-one discussions with myself and some of the legends of RSBNB Update over the last 15 years. And you guys don't know who these people are in all likelihood, you guys who are here right now. But we are talking about people like the first Brad Woodward, our second co-host, Chief Snake, Brad number two, Paul, PFK99s, Earth, and of course Trekkie. And, you know, we wanted to get our very first co-host, Pika, on board, but I unfortunately have lost contact with him. But you can look forward to a series of one-on-one sit-downs with these people who go back years into the podcast. And we're just going to talk a little bit about RSBNB Update Past to focus in on our 15-year anniversary with this. And, you know, this is actually going to be something that's going to be really interesting to do because, you know, we really haven't had a chance to reflect with these people about what the podcast has done, what it meant to them, how they felt doing it, and how things have changed since then. So if this sounds at all interesting to you, just head over to patreon.com/rsbnb. We hope to have the first one up this weekend. And, you know, I'm not going to spoil who the first one is, but it's going to be someone that you guys have heard before. And there might be some other surprises along the way, too. So with that being said,
I suggested to do four episodes with me. But we figured that then every monthly bit in the future would just be completely – would just suck in comparison to those four episodes. So we decided to hold off on that for the time being.
Yeah, and I told these guys here, Tanis and Syria, and I said, you guys probably want to be legends, and you are, but it can't be anyone who's active. So this isn't a solution for you guys to go and retire or an excuse to go and retire. But all of that and more at patreon.com/rsbnb. Thank you so much, everyone. Bit of an abridged Patreon spot, but I wanted to really put the emphasis on our legendary coverage that we're going to be doing this week. And, I mean, I don't know of any too many other podcasts who have legendary co-hosts out there.
The legendary.
Do they get their own jingles?
Come on.
Do they get their own what?
Jingles.
I mean, I would love to have that, but unfortunately we don't. You know what I'd also like to for them to have is I'd like for them to have their own like foil RSBNB update trading card because these are the kind you'd put in the pack that are like the foil Pokemon cards, you know?
Shinies.
Yeah, exactly.
Shiny hosts.
And you guys are working your way up there too, all of you, all of you.
I'll heckle from the sidelines.
No, you're going to be in that deck too.
No, no.
You're going to be in the deck.
How dare you?
All righty. Question this week from Questcaping. Stormguard Citadel, and I should add Questcaping is a Clamp Quest member. Stormguard Citadel is, in my opinion, one of the most visually stunning places in RuneScape. What are your favorites? Let's start with you, Sirion.
Oh, any place. Not just dig sites.
Yeah, any place.
Oh shit, that's way harder. Why did you start with me?
All right. I'll go first then, because, you know, I always have to talk about this. And, you know, dig sites aside, I Everlight is still leaning for me as being one of the most visually stunning. But back in the day, I think, you know, there's different ways of looking at it, different eras, I guess you could say. I never forget that first cutscene of you walking into Prif when that first launched. That was one of the most visually stunning things that RS has had. It's one of the things that I remember covering on the show, speaking of 15 years, and it's something we've been waiting decade plus for to gain access to. So that's always there. Sirion's probably going to shoot me for this, but I have to say Anachronia.
Yeah, I will shoot you, literally.
And probably aside from that, Tardiad is also pretty nice too. The Elven homeworld.
Yes, actually, that's a very pretty one.
So those would be my three or four ideas. Who wants to go next?
I'll go next if Sirion's being indecisive.
I am.
Okay, you can sit and be indecisive for a while. I'm going to ignore the dig sites because that
we were going to cover too easy.
Too easy, yeah. I think ignoring those, it's the Wilderness Volcano Crater with the
really?
Guthic Sword in the crater. I think it's a really beautiful place. That Divination Rift is one of my favorite places in game. With the sword and the atmosphere of it is lovely. The Lost Grove.
Oh!
Solex Islands. Is gorgeous.
Oh, you better say what I'm thinking next.
You all right, Shane?
Yeah, that was. I forgot about that one.
Check your pants or anything, dude.
Um, and then the next area is the area around the needle skips.
There you go. Mm. That's what I was thinking next.
That area of Piscatoris is just so beautiful. So those are my three favorite areas, excluding the dig sites.
Excellent. Tanis?
So he asked about the dig sites, though, right? Like that's the...
Anywhere.
The dig sites. Anywhere.
So I was, like, my favorite dig site had been the Warforge until I got through the gate, and now I don't love it as much. I'm actually kind of starting to really come around to Everlight a lot. But then after that, I have to say, yeah, Lost Grove was the first thing that came in my mind reading this question. So
it's amazing, isn't it? It's so pretty.
That was the first time I thought RuneScape looked different. Like, it was fundamentally something had changed. Like, it was different graphically than it had always been. Those are probably I like that needle area. Wait, there's one other area in. I mean, it's so big, like, but I'm gonna cheat and say the whole thing. So the whole thing, but Freneske is awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
How was that for you, given the coloring there?
Well, that stuff is a little rough, but I think I switched to grayscale on that.
Okay.
When I had to, you know, make things happen. I've spent plenty of time when I didn't have any filters on in there, and I really like Freneske. I think it looks... It's so different, you know what I mean? It's so different from the rest of the other areas in game.
All right. Sirion, have you decided?
I have.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm going to think of something like tomorrow and hit myself. But there's definitely... when it comes to dig sites, I love Warforge, the first area. Like, the second area is disappointing when you get there.
I found the first area so claustrophobic.
But that's what makes it so
great. Yes, yes.
That's what makes it so atmospheric. That, to me, was the first area that felt truly atmospheric in RuneScape, to me, that felt like a whole. Mm-hmm. While it still also is very playable. So, yeah, no, I thought that was really, really well done. Other than that, you know, I'm a sucker for graphical reworks. Falador, for example, like the new Falador looks great. I've seen when they started working on the Sears Village rework back in so many years ago, they dropped the work, but the previous on that looked absolutely amazing as well. But I think the one that I like most is the Wizard's Tower.
Okay.
Could be.
The Wizard's Tower is just, it's a beautiful thing. I every time I come there, I'm impressed still. So I think that's really one of the most stunning places in the game for me.
All right. I think that covers pretty much everything. And, you know, it just shows that what a modern era that we live in, the fact that we can all rattle off different areas that we see as being our favorite visually stunning area in RuneScape. And it just shows the direction that the game has really changed over the past 7 years or so on that. And that's a really good thing to be able to talk about.
Absolutely, and I think we're all in the same boat as Sirion, too, because we're going to think of, like, a bunch of different things as soon as we get off the air tonight. We'll be like, that's... oh, I wish I'd
remembered. Damn. All right. All right. Thank you, Questscaping. If you guys want to send your own questions in, email them questions@rsbnb.com or drop them off to Twitter @rsbnb. Now, we have two tech news this week. We were going to have three, but I cut the third just to save us a teeny tiny, tiny bit of time on this. And, you know, this first one is something that we kind of need to take note of, because we are in a content creator community and everybody knows a streamer here, I'd imagine. And Twitch streamers this week are getting years-old copyright notices for clips that they might have on their channel from the RIAA, or the Recording Industry Association of America, who is now taking issue with music that might have been played on someone's Twitch channel years ago. And, you know, it appears as though for many of these people to combat this is to avoid more strikes on their Twitch account. The only option they have is to bulk delete their clips, because Twitch doesn't have an easy way of sorting through this. And, you know, this is kind of interesting that it comes up this week, because you remember your pick last week, Tanis, right? We actually got a YouTube copyright notice on that from just playing that 30 seconds of audio, even though what we played was in critique of a parody of something else.
Right. So many. You know, and actually, I don't think this is unrelated, to tell you the truth. I listen to a number of podcasts and YouTube stuff, and a lot of people are moving to Twitch or doing things on Twitch, and Twitch has become so big that it's. I mean, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that now that is the new target.
Yeah, and you have no idea how many clips a popular YouTuber has. They can get tens or hundreds
They would have to be older.
Right. And, you know, because, this goes back years.
I was going to say, like a few years ago, I think it was right around the time that I started, Twitch had put in a thing where you can play music while you're live, but it was muted on your videos. Right. You'll mute your videos.
Yeah.
So these have to be like pretty old videos for them to be getting hit, because that audio should be muted to begin with.
Yeah. And even then, you have to ask, you know, how does one who is a streamer, and, you know, streamers don't have legal counsel, how do they protect themselves from this when it just comes out of nowhere, wham, and you're potentially looking at demonetization of your account if you don't respond to this appropriately? I'm not saying that's what's going to happen for people, but how do you deal with that? And Twitch rightly admits they don't have the tools to let people bulk delete any clip that would have a copyright complaint against it.
It is such a messy world as well, right? Like, the problem is the power balance here, right? Like, we can argue all about, like, copyright and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing and what's fair use or not. But in the end, you know, if there's a conflict right now, as the actual content creator, you just start out from the worst position, right? You get the copyright strike, and that your video is offline, right? Like, when it's on YouTube, your video is just demonetized or even taken offline. You get a strike, and, like, right from the start, right from the get-go, you're not generating any monetization on that. So if it's like a video you released the other day, it's your income that you lose. And it very much acts from a you're guilty until proven innocent mechanism. Content creators start from a bad position, and then, you know, you get these companies that are completely lawyered up that you have to go up against. And even if that company sort of overclaims their content, you know, there's no strike system for the actual record holders. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
Like, when you make a mistake, you get a strike against your account, which is super, super punishing. But when a record holder makes a mistake, nothing happens. There's no repercussions. So there's nothing stopping them from just claiming whatever they can, and then, you know, hope that half the people don't bother with taking that up and, you know, trying to get it undone. So the world is super messed up, and, you know, in my opinion, the platform should protect the creators from that as well. I mean, and that's the responsibility they're not taking here.
Apparently one of the Twitch customer representatives told this very popular streamer that the only way to be 100% safe with this is to just delete all your 100,000 plus clips you have.
Yeah, how is that defensible in a modern day world?
Well, and that's not even, and we haven't even touched on, like, I haven't heard of this happening so far on Twitch, but I know it's been a huge problem on YouTube. And what's one thing we know? What happens on YouTube ends up going to Twitch. But there's a lot of false copyright claims all the time. And they do it on purpose because that's another line of revenue for them.
Yep.
You're not going to fight it. You can't fight it. But every penny you make off that video is going to go to them. And they know you're going to let that happen because if you fight it and lose a copyright claim, then it's a strike, not a claim.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they got you over a barrel.
Yeah, like you are actively discouraged from – that's a good point, actually. Like when copyright gets claimed on your videos, you're fine. But when you fight it and you lose it, that's a strike against your account. So the platform is built in such a way that it discourages you from fighting one of these claims. Which sounds so broken to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Like,
I have seen massive channels of passionate people be utterly destroyed or almost destroyed by this. And it is just the saddest thing to see.
And it's not going to stop. Right now it's Twitch. Okay. When they're done with them, they're going to go to Mixer. They're going to go to every one of these. They're not done.
Yeah, this is the newest gambit because they can't go after people who are downloading music anymore because everybody, you know, just gets it from the streaming services and the like. And I actually want to talk about this because there's a tweet this week by Mod Lord, one of the other folks on the music team at Jagex, and he says we release the RuneScape and old school RuneScape soundtracks in a way that means they're not copyright protected on YouTube and Twitch, so feel free to use and now have the hundreds of tracks that we have on our streaming services. And this is Jagex doing this for their game.
Well, that's good because I have heard of streamers before getting hit from just playing the music in the game.
Yeah.
I mean, you still get hit.
There's some really, like, some games like GTA is a big one, right? Like, the soundtrack of those games are actual, like, hip-hop songs, for example.
Yeah.
And some games have original music, like I think Dishonored has some original songs that were written specifically for the game.
Hmm.
But that's good to hear about the RuneScape music in particular. But there's one YouTube channel that is basically a repository of every single RuneScape track that has ever been. And it was taken off a few weeks ago. And a lot of people were really worried, like, has Jagex done a copyright strike on this unauthorized account? So it's good to hear. It did come back after a couple of weeks. I think it was a mistake or maybe a false copyright claim. So it's good to hear that they're not going to strike anyone for using their tracks. And they've put that out publicly that they're not going to do that.
My worry is that, you know, someone is going to come along and they're going to download all those tracks and then upload them to YouTube in a way that does say, hey, I made this. And then they are going to, you know, strike all these tracks because who's to stop somebody else from claiming Jagex's tracks as their property?
I think that's when Jagex lawyers up.
Yeah, but if you hide your tracks, if you hide your tracks well enough, you know, you're just going to run away with the money.
I suppose, yeah.
And in the meantime, all these creators have to deal with the fallout of that. So,
yeah. Not a good situation, but we do have some other tech news this week. We actually, just as of recording here, we got some fresh and juicy details on the PlayStation 5, and in particular on this, you know, I'm not that much of a PlayStation 5 person here, but what we know so far is that we're, of course, getting an expanded and enhanced version of GTA 5, which, you know, seems to always be something that comes along with new PlayStation consoles. We got some details on the hardware earlier, and there's already a meme going around of what is this exactly? It looks like the PlayStation 5 is something with pieces.
The PlayStation 5, it looks really futuristic, and it basically looks like a black box with two pieces of paper stuck to the side.
It does, yes.
It does.
It's a very odd design. I don't like white consoles. I really, really don't like white hardware.
No.
So I hope it'll come in other colors, because I'm not buying it if it's white.
And the controller is also half white and half later. Black.
Give me a rose gold one.
Oh, that'd be neat.
Yeah.
And one of the other things we learned here with this is going to be two versions. You can get one with Blu-ray and one without. And this seems to be just a package there where they're going to show off what the hardware looks like, because we already know all the details of it. But there's also going to be matching headphones with it as well. So they're definitely setting a new standard with this console.
It's super interesting, you know, where console gaming is going. Like, I think console gaming was a big deal, like in the Xbox 360 era and the PS3. Yeah. Like that, those were like big consoles. And I think once we got the PS4 and the Xbox One, I feel they felt like less of a big deal when they came out. I think PC gaming has really picked up since.
Yeah.
But
because if you want a PC game now, there's always a way to do it if you don't have the hardware.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also because, you know, PCs are upgradable, right? You don't have to throw the whole thing away and get a new one like 2 years later, which has always been one of my biggest concerns with these consoles.
Yeah, but the thing with the consoles, this generation of consoles, is these consoles are going to be the cheapest way to do 4K gaming.
That's a good point. And I think also the way it's going to work is that, you know, a lot of games that are going to come out over the next year, they're going to still run on the PS4. Like, the PS4 is not at old yet, right? And same with the Xbox One. Like, these are much more incremental upgrades than, you know, a completely new generation of consoles. And I think hopefully that's going to be a pattern going forward. Like, there's all kinds of advantages to it.
I think the most impressive thing about this whole generation is the SSD and the loading speed. Like, to me, that's the one thing as a console gamer I would actually notice when a lot of the other stuff I wouldn't.
Mm.
But that is noticeable. Like, that makes a difference.
And for people who have this all on their PCs already, it's an SSD. And you want to get a SSD that has similar performance. Get one that's hooked up to the PCIe bus and you're good to go.
So. But yeah, like all PlayStation 4 games will run on the PS5, if I remember correct, and I think the same holds for like the Xbox, which is
Xbox is all the way, and I don't think Sony has quite made up their mind. They said it was going all the way back, and now it's only back to the 4, and there's been some back and forth on that, which doesn't surprise me. Sony's always been kind of assholes when it comes to backwards compatibility.
Like Microsoft is a bit too much backwards compatibility.
Oh, yeah, you can run 360 games on the One, and you'll be able to run that on the new One X as well.
See, I love that, though, because it's being someone that enjoys like retro gaming sometimes, that's kind of cool to me, you know. It just saves me room on other consoles taking up, you know, dust.
I mean, honestly, you know, these announcements, I don't think there's going to be anything that's can be in them that's going to convince me to get them. You know, the only reason I have a PS3, I haven't used it that much, actually. I think it's one of those things that I'm not sure it was worth the effort of getting it. I do have a bunch of Nintendo consoles lying around, mostly because, you know, the ecosystem of Nintendo is very specific. Like, that's just exclusive for some of them. But, you know, people's opinions about exclusives are changing very rapidly. I think we get that much less. Like, your Halo is not going to exclusively come out on your Xbox anymore. And I don't know what Sony does in terms of exclusives, but...
That the first beta version of Halo 3 has arrived today on PC.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
I think it's a lot harder to justify console exclusives because people would rather buy a PC.
Yeah, exactly.
That's never stopped Sony, though.
No,
and the PS4 had success after success after success of exclusives on that.
True, they did have some cracking games.
Yeah, so I mean, I hate it. I don't like exclusives and all that, but yeah, it's going to be hard.
I mean, I have to say though, like at this point, I feel that the Xbox is the better sell because of all this compatibility. I feel that if I get an Xbox right now, I'm going to get more value out of it, and it's going to
and plus
work
it just
better
ties,
with my...
it ties so much better into the Windows gaming experience.
Exactly,
too.
And it just, you know, I would not have expected me to say this like a few years ago, but I feel that Microsoft got their gaming down. You know,
they're getting a lot of stuff right.
They're getting it right, and that's
they're even getting
impressive.
Windows right.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. We got what we wanted out of the PS5 presentation, which is a new meme. So, you know, that's
pretty
that's
cool really trailers cool. as well. I was keeping an eye on the game announcements as well, and it looks like there's some pretty cool ones in there. So there's Horizon Zero Dawn sequel. Mm. There's a new Spider-Man game, kind of a spin-off from Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which is going to be really fun. A few from Annapurna Interactive. And they always make incredible games, or they publish really, really awesome games, so I'm excited for those. Right. So there looks like there's some interesting stuff coming up on it. I kind of hope they're not exclusive.
I guess that's sort of the thing, right? Like, you know, Nintendo you get for the games on the Nintendo. Like, Nintendo you get for your Marios and your Zeldas and your Super Smash.
They're kind of unique games for Nintendo ones, aren't they?
It's just its own little ecosystem.
Animal Crossing on the Switch.
Animal Crossing is massive. Yeah, like you cannot get Switches right now. Like it's just sold out because of Animal Crossing, which, you know, that's doing something right. Sony is sort of doing this, has done the same with the PS4, I feel, or trying to do the same with like all these unique games like Spider-Man and all that stuff. But, you know, there's much less of a... I mean... All these Nintendo games have like cult following at this point, right? Like, if there's a new Zelda coming out, I'm buying it. You know, I'm trash like that. I will just, I will get it. Period. I'm not sure if Sony has that much of a following, well, not that big at least. So it's going to be interesting to see where they're going to go in the future, because I'm not sure if their current model is entirely sustainable.
It'd be interesting as more and more people who game have PCs and customize their own PCs as well, and can consoles even compete with that?
Mm-hmm.
Like that customizability and upgradability?
Well, they'll always be able to compete like that, because, look, until I was able to afford a gaming computer or even step foot in that world, I was a gamer, and I had a console. And I was always a PlayStation guy myself. The last console I got was a PlayStation 3, although I have to say that's much more of a home entertainment thing than
it's part of the reason
else.
I got it.
That's what
well,
the
yeah.
Xbox One initially started out as too, and that's what I use it
and
for.
If I get another console, I would probably go with an Xbox this time, with the Series X, for the same those reasons. But I don't even know if I need that now, because everything that I did on the PlayStation, we kind of do on the Apple TV. Other than play videos. Other than a disc video, you know, like a DVD.
So, like my PS3 was a big deal. Like I ran Blu-rays on it. I used it. I had like it could do like network play videos from network, which was a big thing back then. Like these days you have like Apple TV or like your Chromecast or your Amazon Fire Stick. I think it's called. It's such a stupid name.
Really dumb name.
But like, it's never been easier to just run something on your TV. That wasn't very trivial back in the day. So my PS3 was, yeah, you're right. It was mainly a multimedia device, and it's not needed anymore. So, yeah.
See, the first games I played were on PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3. Like I grew up playing PlayStation games,
But right. since I've kind of graduated onto PC games now, I'm like building my own gaming PC, which has worked out cheaper. Like, I don't think I'd go back to getting a PlayStation. And I'm definitely not touching an Xbox. Because at work, I'm usually assigned Xbox testing. And I fucking hate it. It is the worst thing in the world to test against. Fucking sake, Microsoft, get your shit together.
All right, on that note, I think we can move on to other things. We got the range skill of the month going on. Added Darkmoor has gained just over 1 million XP in the last week or so. Lead change there. Second place, we have Casper with 922K. And in third, we have Rippeth with just 30K. So a little bit of a two-way race going on there. If you guys want to sign up for the Race Myself Agility Contest that begins on June 15th, you can do that too. Just head over to rsbnb.com/SKOTM. Starts on the 15th at midnight game time. And speaking of things that people have achieved on this front, we have some achievements this week. Starting off, we have Colton with 99 Archaeology on June 10th. Hemsky with 99 Dungeoneering. Lady Claw with 120 Farming also on the 10th. Arendelle 20 got 99 Dungeoneering on the 9th, and Mythica UK got 99 Archaeology also on the 9th.
Shade Dardo got 99 Archaeology on June 9. Z got 120 Archaeology on June 9. Taxi got 120 Archaeology on June 8. And then we have two achievements by Lord Dusty, 120 Divination and 120 Archaeology, both on June 7.
Nice.
Warrock with 120 Archaeology on June 7th, Arendelle 20 with 99 Summoning on June 5th, Laniakea with 99 Ranged on June 5th, Siversi with 99 Slayer on June 5th,
I'd imagine,
and
so.
Arendelle 20 again with 99 Prowl on June 4th.
Nice. Then we have Laniakea with 99 attack on June 4th. Laniakea again with 99 strength June 4th. Let's watch. That max has to be coming soon. They're always on here every week. Poitato with 99 fire making on June 4th. Rastafa 120 strength on June 4th. And Stinky Pete 22, 99 mining June 4th. Very nice, guys.
Nicely done, everyone.
Well done.
Nicely done. All right, I'm going to sit here for another 20 minutes, and hopefully our listeners are still with us at this point as Sirion goes through his pick of the week.
Oh, I built up a reputation, haven't I? I'll try and keep it brief. We've already talked about consoles, so I figured I should put a console game on here. Have you guys heard of Crypt of the Necrodancer?
No.
No.
You haven't? Oh my gosh, no. You have missed out, guys. So, basically it's a game where you move on the beat of the music. That's the whole shtick. Also, it's super hard. That's basically it.
Is that because you're white and Dutch?
No.
I'm just curious.
No.
Okay.
No.
You sound so offended.
No.
To be fair, I don't know if he can dance.
I
RuneQuest 2021. Let's find out.
Oh boy, I need to find an excuse to not go now. crying out loud. So, Cadence of Hyrule is my pick of the week. It's sort of a sequel of it. It's the developers of Necrodancer, Crypt of the Necrodancer, teaming up with Nintendo to make a Zelda-specific version of it, where you basically move on the beat of remixed Zelda tracks, which sounds absolutely amazing. It's a game under
iconic.
It is, yes. Like, yeah. All the iconic music. It is not a Zelda game, you know? It is so different, but I had a blast playing it. The beat is great. The music is great. The boss fights are, like, they're puns, first of all. They are all combinations of a Zelda monster boss, like an existing Zelda boss, with an instrument. So, yeah, like the boss monsters are, I need to find the name of this one now. Yeah, so one of the first bosses in one of the Zelda games is called Goma. So, of course, in this game, you get Maracas, where Matt.
Yeah, this is why. It's right within your wheelhouse.
So it's literally a spider that's wearing Maracas is the boss fight. It is, like, the humor on this is fantastic. It's just a great game. It's all completely... It's a bit of a roguelite as well in that, you know, the map is always randomly generated. Every time you die, the dungeon is reset and it's a new dungeon. So, you know, there's sort of these roguelite elements in there. You're going to die a lot. That's a hard game, but it's so much fun. It's a Switch exclusive, but, you know, it's definitely worth checking out. For me, it's one of those games that I take with me when I'm on the plane traveling. You know, it's... You can easily pick it up, play it for a bit, and have a lot of fun. So there, not quite 20 minutes.
Thank you. All right. Sounds good. One of the many reasons to have a Switch, and those things sold out when Animal Crossing came out again, as if it was launch week. So, all right. What have we been doing? I think let's start with you, Tanis, this week.
I'm still rocking Archaeology, 85, cruising. And yeah, I've been collecting energy with the other account. I'm trying to get to 90 so that I can just take care of all my own energy needs. You know, self-sufficient. Energy independent. That's right. But that's really been about all I've been doing RuneScape wise. Other than that, playing the new Greymoor chapter on ESO.
Alrighty. Let's go with you, Diana.
I've been slowly chipping away at Archaeology, getting there. I think a level 96 now, still just slowly working on it. Not had time to do much over the last couple of weeks because work has been... but yeah, just slowly working on that.
Alrighty. Same for me. I hit 96 Archaeology. I think the rest to 97 is going to be through Tetra Compass farming, as I mentioned my complaint with the level 95 spot at Stormguard. But, you know, one thing did happen there. I did get the Archaeology pet this week.
Oh, I got mine at 95, I think.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Interesting. Amazing.
Smart.
But, you know, aside from that, still gathering data on the excavation XP. And it looks, early indications are probably saying a conservative 25% of all XP that you get comes from excavating. And granted, I've only tested this at the 94 and 95 spot. More needs to be done before we can make any assertions on that. I've given up on the figuring out how much health each hotspot has for the time being until we can get some more info on that. So there's a slight update on that front, but I'm going to turn it over to Sirion right now because I wanted to pair two things that were kind of the same back-to-back here on this.
Yeah, I'm also still working on Archaeology. I'm currently in the middle of the 85 to 89 drought of the skill. I'm currently at 87. Yeah, doing pretty well. This morning, I also got the Archaeology pet.
Yay!
Not level 95, level 87. I hit level 87 and the pet at the same tick. So
nice.
You know, I was just, you know, having my breakfast, just half sleepily looking at the screen. I was like, hey, that sounds like a good thing. So yeah. That was this morning, and yeah, I tend to be jumping back and forth a bit between dig sites. You know, I'm definitely farming the Tetra Compasses at Warforge, but yeah, just this evening I've been you know, just doing the Infernal Source because you get Tetra Compasses from there, and it's just a bit of a change of scenery as well, which I think is nice.
All right, so tying this one off, if you guys want to subscribe to us, you can find that on any number of podcast listeners out there, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, practically anything under the sun, YouTube as well, update.rsbnb.com/subscribe, then just click or tap on your favorite one. And, of course, we'll be back next week for another episode where we'll have some of the legends on, probably not all of them, because I don't think we could handle that in one sitting. So look forward to that. And with that being said, see you next week, everyone. Take care.
Bye.